From now on, unlike your parents were, you are the secret force of Retro Asylum.
Playing so fast, they're the only ones who can take you back in time. They play old games, they're more retro than J1 Optimus Prime. At home or the arcade for adventures in a fantasy zone. Pretty soon they'll be off on a mission. Come and hear them.
Hi guys, this is Steve, aka Press Play on Tape, not the podcast, and you're listening to episode 122 of the Retro Asylum. So we've finally got round to doing it. Anyone who says the Retro Asylum are biased towards the C64 and a Speccy are going to be proven wrong today. Why? Well, today's show is going to be all about the Amstrad CPC 464, and I know for a fact that our Amstrad owning listeners are both going to be really happy with this show.
I would be, but I own a 6128.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about 128 owners? Extra memory.
You really had to throw that joke in, didn't you? Really? Come on, sucker punch. You build us up. You go, come on, we're actually going to...
But I don't want to play any games without any sounds. I want some music in my games.
Well, they look good in green.
Yeah, but they're still green on the 6128, but they get music as well.
Anyway, so joining me today to chat all about it is the one and only Dean Swain, Paul Davies and Chris O'Regan of Spong.com, who you might remember from the 8-Bit Wars It Was a Fix show a few months ago. So how you doing, guys?
I'm fine. Yo. It wasn't a fix.
It was definitely not a fix.
Oh, come on.
You bitter C64 owners.
Two Speccy owners versus us. Two Speccy fans.
Yeah, and the Amstrad comes seconds.
One made the list. Anyway,
joint first, weren't they?
Well, joint first in a way, yeah.
I demand a rematch.
Well, we're going to have the rematch, but just not today.
We've spoken, as we said just before we started recording, we've contacted FIFA just to get a heads up on kind of how they go about things, just to make sure everything's run properly and fairly,
without any impropriety or anything like that. Just absolute. Hang on. Did you say FIFA? Oh dear.
FIFA.
Oh well.
I think it was Seth Blatter who did the last list.
Yeah. it was. We did approach him. He seemed to be quite amenable to the whole idea. So we move on.
Yeah. So we'll come back to that. We are hopefully going to revisit the 8-bit wars at some point. But the first thing I want to ask, and this is going to be a burning issue with every single Retro Asylum listener, is Dean, what's the script of this Pole Position theme tune, mate?
What's the script of it?
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
It's catchy. Everyone's singing it. No one can get it out of their heads. It's done its job.
The only person who isn't singing it is the bloody guy singing it.
Listen.
Can't sing.
Well, we've offered the singing part to someone else. I'm hoping they take me up on the offer, so maybe we can have a remix of it soon.
Well, you're saying that it's in everyone's heads, but so is sort of schizophrenia, but not everyone, they're not banging down the door for that.
They're not singing it out loud, though, are they? These people, they've got it stuck in their heads, so it's done its job.
So it's kind of like a mental illness.
That's
a T-shirt.
Asylum,
right there. Retro Asylum, kind of like a mental illness. Well done.
Awesome. Look, it took a while for it to, get in there with people, but most people have accepted it, Steve. It seems to be you who's very bitter. Well, you and Paul keep banging on about it.
No, I just find it funny because I'm being contacted by the people who are doing the UK Podcaster Awards, and we just switched to this theme tune. I'm not sure if it's put them off.
No, not at all. Chris hasn't even heard it yet, so Chris, you've got to definitely tune into this one so you can hear this phenomenal theme tune.
I'm not putting it on this one. I'm in charge of editing this one.
No, it's fine. I insist, I'm in charge.
The thing is, human beings fear change. They do. It's annoying, and it's just the way it is.
So's the theme show.
It really is.
Yes, they fear change, and this happened actually in the realm of Amstrad, actually, and we'll talk about that later on in the show. Bit of an Easter egg there, but not.
We will.
Yeah, we will. There's an aspect of it. It's related to the magazines. Something happened to one of the magazines that caused such a furore that it went on for years. Even after the magazine was closed, it still kept on going. We'll talk about
that. Look forward to that.
I don't necessarily fear change. I just fear copyright infringements, which is equally as disconcerting at times. So.
The lyrics were written by my good self. I have nothing to be ashamed of.
There's nothing wrong with the lyrics. It's the vocal. The vocal is like, you know, when you like sort of stroke a cat's fur the wrong way.
Well, Steve, get into the studio, sing it for us, and
if I get a chance, I'll sort it out.
No excuses, Steve. No All excuses. Right.
Okay. So, what's everyone been up to anyway? Let's get on with this podcast. That question goes to Chris first. You're the guest.
So I'm assuming you want to hear about retro gaming stuff and not any other...
Well, have you been up to anything weird in your life?
Weird?
You know?
Wow.
What would you like to tell us?
I don't know. There's a couple of things that I can regale you about.
You can speak freely here.
Yeah.
You're among friends. No one's listening.
No one's listening. No, least of all after that theme tune. Probably turn it off and in disgust, which, you know, we apologise for everyone for listening to that moment of fast forward. What I've been doing is I played my NES recently. I was just cleaning out some stuff, and there it was, the grey box staring at me going, you haven't turned me on for years. And it's true. So I found myself plugging it in and trying to get the games to work and realising, oh god, all the dirt's accumulated somehow. I don't know, because I keep them in a sealed container, but somehow dirt arrives on the cartridge contacts. I'm sure you've encountered this.
Yeah.
It's weird. You know, you have them all stocked away and nice, you know, make sure nothing. But somehow this dirt appears on the contact. So I, you know, cleaned it all off.
Give it a blow.
No, steady. Again, family show.
You're the one who said you haven't been turned on for years.
I was waiting for the sticker, but yeah, it took a while. No, I cleaned it out, and I played a couple of games on it. I played Basic Mario, because I thought, well, you know, it's kind of a staple. And I forgot how punishingly difficult that game gets very quickly. And it's not the best one, but then again, it was the first one. So there it is. Excitebike. Now, there's a game that keeps on giving. There's a surprising amount of depth to that game. It's all about timing and knowing when to rev up and knowing when to jump, and it's really, really good game. You can get it on the 3DS or the DS, which I've got on my 3DS anyway, and it's fantastic. Fantastic little game.
As you say, there's an amazing amount of depth, especially the 3D version.
Yeah.
Which is it's actually really cool. It's a great game and infuriating, and I enjoy playing all multiple clones of it across all of the other computers that came out back then.
Yeah.
So no, it's awesome.
So good. And then finally, I played Elite. Elite on the NES is bonkers. I mean, think about it. All they had was a D-pad and two buttons and two fire buttons. What do you do with that? How do you make Elite work on that control scheme? But somehow, they did.
Didn't need a lens lock, though.
No.
So there was that.
Then again, nothing needs lens lock. That's the point. That was what I was doing. The other thing I was doing, nothing about retro gaming at all, but everyone, if you know me, those people know me, I'm a big fan of games generally, and I love playing board games. Huge board game fan. And about four years ago, I bought a game called Dreadfleet. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's from Games Workshop. It's one of the rare games we'd actually bought where you don't have to buy figurines and stuff. But the game itself is great. It's basically two fleets of five ships. And you basically bat it out across this big cloth map of sea. Great. So why are you talking about it now, Chris? The problem is, I'm sure you have this as well. Any retro gamer has this as well. They have what they call projects, okay? Mm. Things that they want to do with various things lying around in their office or den or whatever you, they know they're working on, and they've been working on them for years, okay? And this is what happened with Dreadfleet, because Dreadfleet comes in a kit. So all little ships have to be built and then preferably painted. So that's what I've been doing. And I've just got two more ships to paint and I've finished it. And it's just taken a very, very, very long time. Because I've just been, you know, I just go, oh, well, I need to finish that one. I mean, they've had a base coat applied to them for ages. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, so that's what I've been doing is painting those. Because you can't play it without painting them. Because it doesn't look... And it's a fabulous, fabulous game. But unfortunately, it just takes a phenomenal amount of effort and time to actually prepare it ready for play in the first place.
You had your single bristle brush out. A friend of mine used to be big kind of Games Workshop fan and sort of painting all the figures and stuff, and it's incredible amount of detail.
it's thankfully it's not too bad because these are ships, not small people.
Yeah,
so it's a little bit easier. I just had a. Well, I mean, I'm a bit lazy because I do a lot of dry brushing. Those people know what that means.
That sounds weird.
Yeah, if you do lots of dry brushing, it brings out detail, which you normally you have to do with like do with a single hair of brush. But rather than doing that, I just go, oh, fuck it. I'll just... There you go. It's much easier. And it's definitely a case of less is more with some of them. So, yeah, that's what I've been doing. There you go.
And that was episode 122 of the Retro Asylum. So, no, it sounds like you've been doing some cool stuff there, mate. So, so Paul and Dean, Paul, I know you've been off doing some cool interviews, especially the Vega one was pretty immense.
Yeah, I never thought I'd go to the launch of a new Spectrum product. Steve's just going to edit this bit out anyway, isn't he?
Oh, so far I'm editing the first 8 minutes out.
Right, okay.
I got about 30 seconds of good stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's funny enough, Chris, talking about projects and stuff, it's not retro gaming at all, but my dad and I, years ago, decided to put together I used to do like remote control cars and stuff, and boats as well. And we bought a boat called the North Light, which was like a kind of trawler tugboat thing. It was massive, it was. 8 years it took us to actually end up getting around to finishing it, from buying it to having the last kind of coat of paint, and by which time neither of us had any inclination on ever doing anything with it. So it got done, all got to the end, sit there, all the servos, making sure they all worked, and then it's just sat unused in a cupboard. So what a waste of time that was.
So was that like because you took like a seriously massive attention to detail, or because you were both really crap at it?
No, very both Victor, but we just got really bored of it. We kind of just worked our way out of any interest in it, and it just became like an albatross for us. We would occasionally do bits and pieces. It looks really good, and I know my dad keeps joking. That's one of the things that's coming to me, you know, in the sort of inheritance. So I've got North Light coming at some point. But no, it looks really cool. But anyway, that's just as an aside. But I know exactly what you mean, Chris. There are those things that just kind of nag away at the back of your mind that you know you'll do at some time. And I think all retro gamers know that feeling. I know that feeling. And actually, half the fun is being able to do stuff. And then when you're actually able to play it, you never actually do. It's all about the gathering and having and the tangibility.
And that has to stop.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking we're real retro people, I think. And thankfully, social media has done a great deal of that, helping with that. They're actually saying, you know what? Yeah, you've got all these games. When's the last time you played them? And I mean played them. Not tested them for an hour or so. I mean freaking sat there for 3 or 4 hours, maybe longer, 10 hours, playing these games.
But it's kind of like what Paul just said there. For me, it's like part of it, the process of it. There's something like tangibly enjoyable about like grabbing that old game off the shelf, the taking the tape out, popping it in the tape, typing press play on tape, not typing, shift and run stop, sorry, and then pressing play on tape, or you know whatever you did on the weird little specky, and just going through that process of having it load up and having it take 10 minutes all kind of takes you back. All kind of gives you that nostalgic kick.
Yeah.
Best
of the game itself, of course.
Yeah, and like sometimes it is a case of like you'll get it all the way to that booting it up and playing it and then go, oh yeah, wasn't that good now that I'm playing it. But it's like a journey, you know what I mean? It's kind of like making a cup of tea. Enjoy the process just as much as the actual doing it itself.
Yeah, and it is a bit like that. We are, I think, sort of... magpies in a way for that sort of stuff. But Chris is absolutely right. But you have to really commit to putting that time aside and be able to be actually giving it a go. It's like you say with the NES. Actually, yeah, you know, getting through the process of getting it working, you think, well, I better do it justice here, because I've just spent ages with some terps or whatever you want to use on a load of cotton buds cleaning the bloody thing. The fact you didn't get the red blinking light, by the way, Chris, I'm amazed with, because that was the kind of bane of my NES owning life. But yeah, it's all good fun. But yeah, as you say,
well, I did get the blinking light, but I knew why it was doing it.
Yeah, at least why. Yeah,
you just got to clean the contacts. And also, my NES is actually refurbished by me, so it doesn't happen. Basically, it does. There's nothing wrong with the machine itself. If I see any errors like that, I know exactly why it is. It's the cartridge. It's always the cartridge.
Yeah, yeah. But apart from that, yeah, so we had the Vega launch, and the last episode, it was our Kevin Tom's interview, so I think people are starting to get a bit sick of hearing me at the moment. So a bit more of a backseat in this episode, which is nice. outside of that, it's really good though. The feedback that we've had on those shows has been great, and it is a bit of a cliche, but yeah, new Spectrum is something that's kind of garnered a lot of interest, and I think now they've just received their PEGI rating on that, so they've got a 7, which is what they're aiming for. I think the sheer amount of games I think that on there, I'm sure that the PEGI people didn't play all of those games. I think they just sort of took a punt at a random couple of them, although I think they're committed to having no blood or gore, so anyone wanting to buy that device, if you want to play Barbarian, you've got no chance, because it won't appear on it. But yeah, no, apart from that, just doing lots of stuff with the site, and yes, playing games, my mountain of games, my modern gaming pile of shame is increasing by the week, and my retro pile.
Thanks Steam.
Although I did just upgrade to Windows 10 yesterday, so a lot of stuff just doesn't work at the moment. So I'll go with
that. That'll learn you.
Yeah, well, you know, I just had to do it. So yeah, more for me for wanting the new shiny.
Fair play. So what about you, Dean? Are you still with us?
Well, funnily enough, yes, I am still here, thankfully. And regular listeners who love the theme tune, by the way, will know that I ordered a multi-cart for my Vectrex, which has arrived, and it is absolutely superb. It's got an SD card, so you can download anything that you want to put on it, because there's a lot of public domain for the Vectrex. You know, there's a lot of stuff being coded these days, modern games, they're retro games, but it's, you know, the machine,
new releases.
Yeah, they're new releases, very big homebrew scene for the Vectrex, and the way they're pushing the machine, and have been for the past few years now, you're getting games that they're old fashioned games, but they look amazing and sound amazing. Funnily enough, the Vectrex shares the same sound chip as the Amstrad. So I know that doesn't go down too well with a lot of C64 owners, but you know, the AY chip can do some pretty good stuff. So
you know, I used to call it the wobbly chip.
Yeah,
not because it was wobbly, but that's the sound that they genuinely went for was that
same. Yeah, I mean, there's a cartridge on the Vectrex called Protector, and it's got two games on it. One's called Yazzy, which is yet another Space Invaders.
Yeah,
and the other one, that's actually called Protector, and it's a Defender clone. Mm-hmm. And it looks and plays amazing, as does the Space Invaders game. Although it's just Space Invaders, seeing it done on the Vector screen, the way it's done, is something else. So, yeah, I've been enjoying that.
I get sad with Vectrex because mine's broken, very, very broken.
Well, mine was when I first got it, but, you know, I've revived it. So, great system. Really, really do love that. Paul gave me his MAME cocktail cab to store because he's run out of room in his house. So that wasn't the two-player joystick on it wasn't working. So that's been fixed this week. So I've been tweeting out a few pictures. My son and I were playing Bubble Bobble on it, which was nice. What else? Oh, I got the my 48K Spectrum, which I bought last year, was it last year or earlier on this year? I found that for 50 quid at a Cash Converters. It was boxed.
Oh, the minty one.
The mint one, yeah.
That was awesome, that one.
Yeah, so I got that out of this box and had a play about with that as well this week. It just looks such a nice machine.
Is it untouched then?
Totally untouched until I found it, you know, earlier on in the year.
Wow.
It looks amazing. You'd think it's one of these keyboards that Elite are producing.
Yeah.
You know, the Bluetooth keyboard.
Is it grey keys or blue keys?
It's the second,
blue was the later one.
Yeah,
isn't it?
The blue keys. So
I actually prefer that, so whatever.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it just looks the part and it all works fine. So yeah, I was just playing some 48K games on that, and it's nice to hear them come through the beeper rather than a TV speaker, because Manic Miner, it sounds awful when you listen to it through a TV, but on the beeper speaker, it doesn't sound too bad. So,
and yeah, you can upgrade that speaker, don't you?
Yeah,
you can upgrade speakers.
Yeah, I just want to keep it nice and standard. It goes back in this box. It's still got all the wrap tires that go around the leads. You know, it's got the warranty. All the instructions are sealed.
I love looking at that stuff. It's like it is really looking at the past.
Yeah,
you see all the phone numbers that are too short. And the post goes like, that's not right. And it's just these little things that only we know to pick up on, like, that number won't work anymore. You know, it's just little stuff. But it's like 30 or 40 years ago. It's amazing.
You're tempted to return one of those sort of survey cards.
Yeah.
Games or whatever. Have you sniffed any of the... No, be honest, Dean. Have you sniffed any part of this box
no,
or the
I
Spectrum?
No, I tell you what,
you want to take in a whiff of...
The polystyrene bits of that are coming away. Not badly, but just the odd dot. And my missus goes mad. You know, she finds a little bit of, you know, white polystyrene on the floor. She goes absolutely berserk. She is the Monica of Essex. So, she hates mess. But that's been my fortnight, really. So, yeah, Vetrex, the main cab, got that working completely, which is really nice.
Yeah.
And actually, just this evening, I posted out a video. I was playing Toki, so that's gone up.
Spitting all over the place.
Yeah, spitting.
I mean, just talking about Spectrum stuff on there, which we were. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but there was an auction on eBay where someone's got man. Yeah, there is an auction
on
eBay.
An auction on eBay.
Yeah, yeah.
No.
Oh, he's so facetious, Chris. of concept art and like a presentation document for Bandersnatch.
Okay.
Which features a mock-up of the box and it's a curious thing, and the sad thing is it's up on eBay and it's not being kind of, you know.
It needs
put
to go
somewhere.
To a museum, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but it's got...
It belongs in a museum.
Yeah, put it behind glass. But it's I think they'd approach the thing as it would be in association with Sinclair.
Yeah.
So that's how...
imagine we're in a bad way, weren't they, financially,
yeah.
while they was developing the game, as we all know, through the documentary that went out on the BBC.
That is an amazing documentary.
Mm. Very good, yeah. Oh.
It's definitely, again, the window on a period of time that you feel like reaching back and going, you have no idea what you're doing! And then, you know, like, honestly, it's one of the things, like, little fantasy I've got, is like going back in time with current hardware we have now and just showing it off to everyone and go, that's where this is going. And they would all crap their pants. They would just be running from the room, like, no, this is too much. Like, yep, that's where it's going.
Yes, it's quite sad that every single member of the Retro Asylum, and probably you as well, Chris, is if we could get hold of a time machine, we'd just go to the 80s.
We'd just go to the 80s?
That's it.
Yeah.
No, anyway, find out if God existed. Were the dinosaurs real? I'm going to the 80s.
No, I'm going to the 80s, 1985, W. Smith. Yeah. What? Yeah. Why? Because I want to buy that copy of Elite again. No!
They said you can only go back in time if you go to John Menzies. No, yes! I don't want to go there.
Woolworths.
Don't have anything.
Rumbelows.
Well, Dina go to Woolworths to pick up their entire stock of Vectrex stuff.
Vectrex and Transformers. W.H. Smith, Woolworths were very big on Transformers.
Someone on Facebook posted a picture of their retro setup and had a Spectrum sat right next to a C64. And I said, you can't do that. That's heretical.
I've got all three in a row. I've got the C64, the Spectrum in the middle, of course, and then the Amstrad 6128 to the right.
Yeah,
we won't mention the GX4000 that's like been relegated to the very end of the shelf.
Poor thing. But it's just, when you see that, you think, that's horrible, that's heretical. And then someone said, but that was in Boots. Like, yeah, but that's the only place it could be. Like, in someone's home? That's just wrong. But yeah, it's quite funny. No, they've all said in jest, but yeah.
Yeah. That Bandersnatch is insane. And hopefully, well, I kind of tweeted it out to a few people who are in the kind of in the business, so to speak. So hopefully they might secure it for a collection that everyone might be able to be able to get some info about. So yeah, come on, Paul Andrews of Retro Computers.
Yeah, please do get it.
Well, Paul's got loads of, he's got huge amounts of Spectrum stuff, and he's interested. But it was really interesting to see just how, I mean, not amateur the stuff is, but it's all hand drawn, and it's like. Do you ever do those kind of graphic design projects at school where we had to do when we had to design an aftershave and design a box for it and that sort of, and it's just that. That's all it is.
Yeah.
It looks pretty cool. But
Look at the concept art that's coming out from Ultimate and the stampers, they're releasing this stuff on Twitter going, oh look, this is our loading screen for Alien 8. That was the one recently I think it's the day released that. Went, what, you just scribbled on a bit of graph paper? Well, yeah. How else are we going to do this?
I know. It was a different... Honestly, it was just a different world,
wasn't
it?
What I think's ironic, though, is that Imagine Software actually went to Sinclair in hope to get funded, and Sinclair went bust themselves not long after Imagine. So.
Yeah, that was one of those where we're not going to tell you where we're at. We're both sides are kind of thinking we're in a bit in hot gear and it's not going to work. And, they went to the wrong... Maybe should have given Alan Sugar a ring, you see? That was the problem.
Well, they should have gone to EA. EA were there at the time. They were around at the time. You don't know this, but they were around at the time.
They were floating. But so that's. I don't know. By the time this comes out, that auction, the new owner will probably be known. But it probably is. Yeah. It's not going to be me by the time it ends. I wouldn't imagine. So
how much is it going for?
It's very good you asked that question. £200 at the moment.
That's not bad.
Yeah, with three,
well, a bit of memorabilia like that. That's not bad.
Yeah, but you can, you know.
Oh, 3 days to go.
A few days to go. Within the last few minutes, that'll just
fly up.
Yeah.
So let's add 1,000 to that, shall we? Maybe. So
Cool. So, what have I been doing? Thanks for asking.
What have you been doing, Steve?
Yeah, what have you been doing?
So I've been working on my games room. I'm sure I've sent you some pictures of this stuff.
Well, it's funny enough, because we were talking, weren't we, about using RetroBright
in
the last episode, and you sent me some pictures of your Amiga 600. Now, I bought the stuff that you recommended, Steve.
Yeah.
And I put it on my Amiga 1200 today.
Yeah.
And it is now a melted puddle of mess in the garden. No, I'm joking. It done wonders. It's done the job and it's cleaned it all up.
Does it look good?
It looks very nice, mate. So that Kickstarter for the new cases for the A1200 can sod right off.
Just as an aside, though, it is still temporary. I mean, that stuff is still in the case, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it lasts about 4 or 5 years. If they put sunlight on it again, it'll start going yellow again because of what's...
Yeah, it's in a dark room now. No... worries
it's
about
in,
that.
It's actually in the plastic. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
So it's just you cleaning away.
No, where my A1200 is stored is a dark room. Yeah. So
it's my one of my C64s. I've got two C64Cs. I know. I've got two of them. One of them, I know.
Chris, what are you doing? Get the decent version.
I should get a bread bin, shouldn't I? I've been wanting to get one, but. You know, anyway, bit as it may, one of them is quite yellow. I mean, really yellow. It works fine, of course it does. But, you know, I've been pondering the idea, but the reason I stop is like, well, it's just going to come back. But, you know.
Anyway, Steve, what were you about to tell us after I batted in, then Chris batted in? What have you been up to?
So I've been like working on the games room. If you remember at the play Blackpool. I picked up that Retron 5, didn't I?
Oh, yeah. You got rid of that, didn't you?
Yeah, well, this is what I've been doing. I've sort of, like, gone from a Retron 5 Then I got rid of that and managed to pick up a big bundle doing a swap on a Facebook group. I ended up with loads. I ended up with a Speccy Plus 2, a Breadbin Commodore 64, a Mega Drive 2, a load of games, a light gun, the works, an absolute ton of stuff, all in really nice condition as well, like all boxed, all in nice condition. And that was just a straight swap for the Retron, because this guy really wanted one. And then I swapped some of the other stuff then. I swapped the C64 and the Mega Drive and ended up with an Amiga 600, which I then sold, and I've now got an Amiga 1200.
Oh,
with with a 4 gig hard drive built in.
Yeah.
So cool. And I've retro-brighted both the Amigas, so the picture I sent you is the new one.
Yeah.
That retro-bright stuff's amazing. Well, it's not retro-bright either, it's just peroxide mousse, which is what people use for hair, like, but it seems to work a treat. Yeah, definitely seems to work a treat, like. So yeah, been getting into the old hardware for once instead of.
How have you got on with the Spectrum? Have you managed to figure out how to load games, unlike some of our other staff members?
I have. What was it? Shift and run? No, not shift and run. Stop. It's J-load quotes. J-load quotes.
Quote quote.
Yeah.
Quote quote.
Hit return.
Well, let's get it right. It's J.
Symbol shift.
Symbol shift. There you go.
P.
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's not, because it's a Speccy Plus 2. So you
just press enter.
Just press enter, and it tells you press play on a tape. Or press play. I keep just dropping my own name in.
Oh, it's like the name. Press play on tape, like the band.
Like the band.
There's a band called it, another podcast called it, who totally ripped you off. I saw you coming.
I'm going to get rid of this name, I'm sick of it now.
But what an interesting switch for someone to really want a Retron 5 that much.
Yeah.
Seems like really, it's...
I mean, I'm going to ask you why you got rid of yours, but my opinion, my problem, I don't have one, and I'm thinking about it for another reason, but the real reason, because I'd like to do some video and video capture for one of those, way much easier than getting for my actual machines.
Yeah.
But my quandary of it, my worry is that I know what it is. I mean, we all know what that machine is. It's an emulating machine. Yeah. It's a computer which downloads the data from the cartridge and then runs an emulator.
Yeah.
Is that why you balked it? Is that why you got rid of it? Or was it another
thing? No, I'll tell you what. I mean, as a machine for what it does, it's fantastic. You can't get closer to playing the real hardware, because you are literally grabbing an actual cartridge off a shelf, shoving it in the slot, using the real controller.
Yes.
And then watching it on your telly, only with the benefit of like plugging it into 1080p HD, you know, setup, and then using filters and everything to make it look old school, and saving where you're up to in the game. As for what it does, it's really, really good. However, for me, it was like, I didn't own a Nintendo back in the day, didn't own a Mega Drive, didn't own a SNES or a NES. So none of these things were like giving me a real nostalgia kick. None of it was like taking me back. You know, I was just like going, this is cool, I'm playing Sonic the Hedgehog, this is cool, I'm playing Mario Brothers, but I didn't own them back in the day. I've just played them in since. And it was like, what I'm actually missing out on is playing things I do remember from back in the day, playing Commodore 64 games, playing Speccy games in my mate's house, you know, and that was what I was missing. I was like, so this isn't really ticking a box for me, it's not filling a gap. And it's like, this is worth trading in and getting the real stuff so I can actually play the stuff that I remember. So that was it then, and like, as soon as I did it and I swapped and I got the Commodore and the Speccy and the Amiga and stuff, then I was back in the zone.
So really, you need a machine that emulates the Spectrum, Commodore and Amiga?
Kind of, but then...
There's no need now because you've got the real hardware, yeah.
Yeah, the real hardware, there's no comparison.
No, there isn't. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm not knocking emulation. A lot of people think that I'm really anti-emulation. I'm not. It's a great thing, but if you can manage to find the real hardware and you've got the space, it does seem, for me anyway, it makes it that much better.
There's something about it.
Yeah,
I don't know what it is. There's something about plugging in a Kempston interface and then somehow jamming a joystick into the side of that
and watching
plug
your Spectrum
for some reason.
Crash.
Yeah, and then, you're not turning the machine on while you're doing that, because that's nuts. But, you know, and then realizing that the quick shot doesn't work with Spectrum and it's just all of that. It's just part of the experience. You know, it sounds ludicrous that you're going to willing to sit there and wait for 5 minutes for a game to load. It's absurd.
But that's part of the process. That's what I was saying before. That's part of the pleasure. It's actually, I mean, even when I was emulating stuff, I was letting it load in like normal time. I wasn't using the speed up, like fast forward it so it just loads instantly. I was like, no, I'll whack it full screen and I'll have it so that it takes 5 minutes to load. And I'll listen to the loading music and watch it colour in the screen with an image.
Well, like you say, that's part of the memory, isn't it? Especially on the C64, the loading music. That was a big part of it.
Took so long, though. But yeah,
even the fast loader stuff. I just feel there's a certain detachment that you tend to feel with emulation, which means you generally just play a game for less time because you just kind of jump to one thing and then one to the next and to the next. And I think it's different between computers and consoles. Not the Retron 5, but the other day, and I can't remember what the name of this thing was, and I'll dig it out. But there's a new device which is about to come out in Japan, which plays. It's like a new console, emulation console that plays everything, even through the kind of PC Engine stuff. And I cannot remember from my view what the name is, but we might stick it in the show notes or something. But that doesn't deal with sort of dumping information onto the console or anything. So there seems to be a new kid on the block, but there always seems to be a new kid on the block with these things. But I know people who've got the Retron 5, and it generally just leads to people then just going and buying the original stuff anyway. I think that's the natural place.
Definitely, but there's something else about emulation that I just really want to point out. Is what's really cool about it is you can very quickly do a comparison between the same game on different ports very, very quickly.
Absolutely.
So I did that with Rick Dangerous recently, which I saw why.
Cruel.
But I was just playing. And I thought, well, okay, let's play the Amstrad version, let's play the, you know, the C64 version, and then let's play the ST version, which is the version I was familiar with. Because by the time Rick Dangerous came out, I had an ST, and that was that. I was working then. There you go, let's put that in. Point is, turns out the SD version just knocked the socks off everything else.
Really?
But the C64 version really held up as well. So yeah, that's the really good thing about emulation. You can very quickly play the same game in different ports. You know, even in three different windows on your machine at the same time, because our machines are that powerful now. But you know,
emulation definitely has its place. I mean. It's easy access to stuff and getting to things really quickly. And I think even like Paul's just done there with the Vega, like that's kind of partially emulation.
Well, it is emulation.
It is emulation, isn't it?
Yeah.
But even then, I'm still interested. I'm still interested in having a convenient way of doing stuff as well.
Yeah.
I love having the old stuff and I love taking time. That's like when you've got an hour to spare or half an hour and you just want to sit and enjoy that experience. But if you actually just want to quickly play some stuff, there's a place for that as well. You know.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know, that's why the Vega's cool. That's why the Vega's still interesting to me. It's like, so what you're telling me is I could just have 1,000 specky games just right under my TV,
If you put, you know, that does come with an SD card, so you can put more stuff on it.
Yeah, so I can have every game basically.
Yeah,
I'm definitely not a kind of salesman for those guys, but. If you end up actually getting your hands on one to play with it, I pretty much guarantee that most people who do will end up buying it. I think the distance is the hesitation for a lot of people.
Yeah.
If they want to kind of get out and on the circuit, I think they definitely kind of win a few more hearts and minds by doing so. But it's a cool little device. It's very, very cool, and I'd expect more to come from those guys. I don't think they're going to stop with that system.
Do you think? I mean, I was thinking this when you were doing the podcast. Do you think they're going to go to other systems?
Yeah.
And I don't mean Spectrum. I mean, do you think they'll try and do like a Commodore one or an Amstrad one or something else?
Well, I mean, all of those guys are so inextricably kind of steeped in Spectrum stuff. Given that they're one fans and two, you know, Chris Smith did programming for.
Yeah, they've got a history
on the Spectrum. They do, and I think as a proof of concept, I think they've proved that they can do it. The quality of the stuff's really good. I think if this one goes well, they'd be foolish to stop there and not look at, say, a C64 one or, you know, an Amstrad. You know, an Amstrad one, maybe.
This episode of Retro Asylum would not have been possible without the kind donations from the following people. Dino Dini, Gazappa Games, Brendan Griffin, Michael Keefe, Nicholas Lees, Garen Tungate, bitsmacbooks.co.uk, and as ever, retromash.com. Guys, thanks for the donations, and if you would like to support the podcast, please visit retroasylum.com. On our homepage, if you scroll down to the bottom, you will find a donate button, little PayPal logo on there. Hit that and please donate. It does keep the show going. Thanks a lot, guys.
So today, like we said before, the show is going to be all about the Amstrad. What we're going to do is, like, we're going to talk about sort of what made it special. Well, I say we're going to talk about. Chris is going to talk about what made it special. We'll sort of talk about some of the games, some of the magazines, and maybe talk a little bit about the end of its lifespan. So, Chris, do you want to start, like, giving us a little bit of your memories of, like, your first Amstrad and, you know...
Okay, well, what I'm about to say, you may shriek in horror about, but how I came upon owning an Amstrad CPC 464...
You lost the competition.
With a colour screen. No, I didn't lose the competition. Well, this is the thing, what I'm about to say, again, you will shriek in horror, but this is exactly what happened. I had a Spectrum Plus. Okay? Then I defected. I actually left.
Oh, traitor.
A complete traitor. I went, you know, I actually quite like the Amstrad. I was playing on one. I used one in stores and stuff. And, like, I really, really love the richness of colour in the games. They are... That's the thing that sold me on them. And the screen. Freaking screen. Was just amazing. I'm talking about a colour one.
Green,
was just
green.
Like, no, I had a colour one. So I had a 464 colour screen, and I sold my Plus with all the games and stuff, and basically started again, started a new with another 8-bit machine, but I actually defected. So that would give you some idea of where I was coming from with the Amstrad. So my memories of it were pretty fond, of course, because I didn't have buyer's regret. Okay, I. So one of the first games.
Did you not consider the C64?
No.
You didn't. Because you just I had the Amstrad.
I had friends with both Spectrums and C64s, but no one had an Amstrad. And we often talked about this, and I had a friend as well with an MSX, so I was playing Konami games on that. So we're like, well, Chris, do you want to do the Amstrad thing? Yeah, just basically, it was almost maybe like peer pressure. I don't know. Like, yeah, why not? I suppose everyone else has got the other stuff. I'm able to just have the Amstrad thing. It was quite funny. I do remember the playground yelling matches, and when my voice piped up about the Amstrad or the Amstrad port, I would get shut down by both the C64 and the Spectrum owners, and they'd say, "Shut up, Chris, you're neutral on this." And that was what they would say. They'd go, "No, Chris, you're Amstrad. You're neutral on this. You don't have any input in this discussion." They didn't say it in those two words because that's very grown up. It was about 13 or 14. But I do remember having those conversations. So, Chris, you know, you're Amstrad. You're separate. You're outside this conversation. One of the first games I played on it was a game called, I think it was called Kane. It was a Mastertronic game.
Yep.
And that was fantastic on the Amstrad. That really made the, you know, showed the machine off quite well with the colour graphics and extraordinary colour. You know, that's what I loved about it. A lot of games, not all of them, a lot of games didn't have the, didn't emulate the Spectrum so much. They did the full colour and all those extraordinary palette that it had and really showed the machine off and made it sing. When you saw those games, and the games we're going to talk about in the show are basically show off that for the most part. It didn't have color clash at all. It did have three modes of graphics. It had mode 0, mode 1 and mode 2. Mode 0 was where it had the full color palette, and then mode 1 was where it had only four colors, and that's when you saw games and Amstrad games, and it looked like Spectrum games.
Well, I quite liked them though, because you could have a, you know, different color on the sprites, whereas on the Spectrum a lot of the time color, you know, the sprites would take on the color of the backgrounds. Where on
granted, it was still only four
Amstrad versions. I know it didn't appeal to a lot of people, but I don't know. I found those nice, crisp looking graphics.
Yeah, and it worked very well in Enduro Racing, for example, exceptionally well in Enduro Racing. And then there's mode two, which was only two colors, but it had 80 column, high res, but that was for mainly for word processing and spreadsheets and that sort of thing, which I never used my 464 for. So should we talk a little bit about hardware? Just a little bit?
I mean,
let's do that. So there are essentially three different types of Amstrad CPCs. Okay, there's the 464, which had the built-in tape deck, and that was the thing that threw me when I first saw this. I'm like, wait, no more volume or anything? Nope, you just press play and then off it goes. And it, you know, the keys on it looked like keyboards, but actually was just like a regular tape deck. It's just, you know, they looked like it. It looked like you pressed them down, but it's just like a regular tape deck. But it don't, you know, it went straight in. It's pretty well built. I own one now, and it works fine. It needed the heads cleaning, and there is an alignment, head alignment thing that every tape loading and 8-bit machine had problems with, and the Amstrad was definitely not immune from that. But no, it is very, very reliable. The problem with it was, like the C64, if a game didn't load, that was it. There's not a lot you could do, apart from moving the aligning the heads and that sort of thing. There was not a lot you could do, because there was no volume. Whereas in the Spectrum, you had that, oh, I'll try it again with just a little bit louder. But, you know, that's calls for the 464.
So that meant you didn't need to own any Tippex then, once you'd kind of dumped the Spectrum for the Amstrad, because that's what we had, the little mark on the volume control. So we always knew that was the kind of optimum
point. Only if
point.
You own a 6128.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll come to that in a second. Another unique aspect of the 464, which I've spoken about in the 8-bit war show, was the single joystick port. One, I know why they did it. It's for, you know, money and stuff, but they just had the one. And if you wanted another joystick, you had to daisy chain it onto another joystick with a joystick port on it that was already on it. Now that was a special joystick that was just awful. The actual Amstrad joystick was abominable. Just awful, awful thing.
Yeah, it's the same model they used Amstrad bought Sinclair out. They released those joysticks as Sinclair joysticks.
They're
absolutely awful.
And what we had to do was, basically, most people did, they just got a special adapter which cost about £10. And you just had then two joystick ports plugged into the same one. That was fine. So that was okay. Now, my 464 turns out had a bug in it that didn't actually recognize the second joystick properly. But my ones I have now do actually recognize it. But only one joystick port. Very odd. The power, that was weird. In fact, it's a big problem now when you buy a 464. If you buy one now, be very careful how you buy it, because if you buy it without the monitor, it's kind of useless. Because
Dean's
asserting his non-Spectrum owner status on the podcast.
I can let you come in, but I just want to talk about this, because there's something that's a bit weird. It was powered by the monitor. So the monitor that it came with powered the Amstrad, the keyboard.
That'll be the green screen, would it, Chris?
No, the blue, not the green screen, no, the colour one. I said I had a colour one.
Did it give you extra power?
It did, actually. It was a good one. But the point is, it had power sort of feeding into the Amstrad itself. But there was also a plug socket on the bottom of it, like a, I think it's 5 volts, or might be, it was a definite number, and that's for if you had a 6128 or a 664, because it needed extra power for the floppy disk drive. So the 664 is the same as the 464, with 64K memory, same ROM, everything, except it didn't have a tape drive. It had a floppy drive, a 3.5-inch, three-inch, a floppy disk drive, which those of you familiar with the +3 Spectrum will be very familiar with. That's a very odd-looking floppy disk.
Quite tactile, though. They're quite nice, tidy,
very,
sort of...
They make good frisbees.
Very, very thick. Very thick, very robust. Definitely weren't, they were not floppy at all, but they were 3 inches. They weren't the 3.5, which eventually took over the world. which, by the way, the C64 did adopt if you have a 1518 with 1581 drive, which I do. They didn't adopt that for some reason. They adopt this other proprietary thing. It's a bit like HD DVD. Microsoft did.
I own one of those.
Yes, yeah, and I. Anyway,
you can't win them all.
Now, unfortunately, those drives, and the C64 is very, 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 very rare. It also looks very different to the 464. It hasn't got the big bright colour keys, because the 464, at least in the UK, had a big green key and a red key. It was the Escape was red, and it was all very brightly coloured. The Schneider, which is the German version of the Amstrad, was all very dull. It was all yellow keyed and black, and it was all quite, dull, but it was still an Amstrad. You might see, games like, but Amstrad and Schneider, that was the same thing. But 664 was very, very different. It had bright blue keys, like cyan keys, very bright blue. And I do remember the D-pad, the director's cursor keys, were these big, fat yellows, triangles, very strange. So it looked very, very different to the 464. Very, very rare now. When you see rare on an eBay, it actually is true. If you see them on eBay, they go very quickly and they are very, very hard to find. I don't own one. I don't know anyone who owns a 664, actually. They're very short-lived. But you can buy floppy disks for floppy disk drives for 464. I have a floppy disk drive for 464. You basically plug it into the back of the expansion port, and then voila, you've got a floppy disk. And they are prone to being, their drive belts deteriorate over time very, very quickly, and they do need to be replaced. If you get one on eBay, hasn't been tested, guaranteed that that won't work, because the drive belt, unfortunately, there's lots and lots of those outlets out there. We're more than willing to sell you a packet full of about 10 belts.
Are they easy to change, Chris? Do you know?
Say again?
Are they easy to change, the belts?
Very, yeah. Very, very easy. Even
like Spectrum, pretty straightforward as well, aren't they?
Very, very straightforward. It's just, don't try to get anything like just something like a plastic band in there or anything like that. That won't work. You do actually need a very specific kind of belt with a certain amount of tension in it in order for it to work. It's very, very easy. Even I can do it. But then again, I've done some soldering and stuff like that. So, but it's not, you don't need that. It's just basically, what happens is you open it up and you realise that the belt that was there is disintegrated into nothing. And you just have to peel it away. I remember doing this, peeling it away. And it disintegrates in your hand as you do so. And then you replace it with a brand new one. It's fine. And then the drive is perfect. Absolutely great. It's not like micro drives, it does actually work. What else can I tell you about then there's the 6128, which is more or less the same as the 664, only it has 128k of RAM as opposed to 64. Clearly there is possible to use external tape drives on the 664 and the 6128. And that's when you can use the volume and actually get away with a little bit of leniency when you're loading stuff. But, I own a 6128. That's my go-to machine typically when I'm playing or messing around with my Amstrad. But I do have a 464 as well. Don't know why. I just do. what else can I say
so
about it?
What does CPC actually stand for, Chris?
Isn't it Colour Personal Computer? Might be wrong. But, sort of thing Amstrad would come out with. Yeah, Amstrad Colour Personal Computer. Yeah, what is that?
It wasn't an extravagant name like the emailer. Yeah, it's called one of their best named products.
Yeah, they really, really lost their way. The only way Amstrad made money during the 2000s was the dishes they made. Yep. If it wasn't for that, they would. Mr. Sugar would be Mr. Sugar to this day.
Yeah. there was a very famous thing that Sky had where they at that point they were taking their boxes made by Pace as well. They were a box made by Amstrad, and you were allowed to ask the Sky engineer what manufacturer the box was that he was going to fit. And everyone would ask, because have you got a... the question was, have you got an Amstrad box? It was always, have you got a Pace? Have you got a Pace one? And because someone I know used to do them, and he's like, oh yeah, everyone used to just... Then he'd say, no, just, I think it's Amstrad. And then he said the people's face used to kind of drop. Go, oh, okay then.
But, okay, then. Yeah,
all right, I'll have my football, but I think Alan does have all the gold he can eat, so I think he gets the last, he has the last laugh with all of that, I think.
But that is kind of part of the problem, isn't it? A little bit. Like, I remember when I was younger, like, Amstrad, forget the computer, Amstrad stuff wasn't very good.
No.
I just remember my dad got an Amstrad Hi-Fi and it was
crap. That was the thing, wasn't it? They made Hi-Fis and, as you say, their reputation on them was absolutely abysmal.
Cheap.
Yeah. But despite that, here we are talking about machines that I've got, you know, two machines. Some of us here do have them. Still work. Still work. And that says a lot.
Well, even the, when Amstrad bought Sinclair out, I think most people will agree that, you know, their machines were actually more reliable than a Sinclair branded one.
Yeah. Well, that's what you'd always recommend someone to get, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it's true. You do. To this day, we do that. But there's a couple of things I want to address now, which is kind of interesting how, you know, Amstrad evolved, how these machines evolved. Now, the period of time I'm about to reveal to you now is a time when I actually left the Amstrad. So I didn't personally experience it at the time. I just saw it happen at the time. Okay, so this is a bit third party looking from the outside in. Because like I said, I'd sold my Amstrad by this time. I'd defected over to... Well, I upgraded onto the ST and the Sega Master System by then. So I'd moved on to the land of 16 bits, at least the computers and 8-bit consoles, which has now made a return. But what happened was they released the Plus models. The Plus models are quite rare to find. Not that rare, but they're quite rare to find. And there's the Plus 464... and the Plus 612, which is very hard to find. And they are very different machines. They do come with their own monitors and that sort of thing. But rather than the modelling of the mid-80s, which is broad black or green or, you know, they basically reinvented and reshelled they rebooted the brand and turned it into this beige computer, like PC computer, like
they were hoping that people would pick them up and think they was buying an Amiga by mistake, didn't they?
Yeah, could well be. Some very silly, stupid people might have done that. Now, they came with a cartridge port, which has never been there before, and this cartridge port was for the GX4000.
What a console!
Was a Amstrad based 8-bit console to compete with the likes of Sega.
Well, it blew Sega and Nintendo out of the water, didn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It dominated the whole region for decades. And I'm sorry, I can't keep up this sarcasm. No, it didn't.
That really burned rubber.
Burned rubber is actually a good game. It's not that bad. It's not that bad.
We've been playing it for the past couple of weeks because I have...
It's the only game Dean has.
Yeah, I've recently bought the GX4000.
Not that bad. It's not that bad. I've played far, far, far worse. And it does... those machines had a little bit more to them. There's a little bit more colour to them. They could handle sprites and that sort of stuff. So there's a little bit more to them, but only if the developers actually exploited that code.
Which they very rarely done, unfortunately.
Very rarely did, because there's no one owned these machines. I certainly didn't. Like I said, I was the target audience, and I've moved on, you know. But they were. If you can find them, they are slightly better build than the original machines. But I don't know one. I've been tempted to get one, but like I said, I've already owned two Amstrad machines, and they work perfectly fine, so what's the point? But the last thing I want to talk about, you may think, hang on, Chris, we're talking about CPCs here, but like all three manufacturers, they had to emigrate or evolve into the land of 16 bits, right? I mean, Spectrum couldn't do it because it was owned by Amstrad at the time, but the C64, the Amiga, that the Commodore went with the Amiga, and Atari came in from out of nowhere and arrived the ST. Mm. So the 16 bits had arrived, and Amstrad couldn't ignore this. So what did they do? They created the PC 200. This is where we depart ways. We go, Chris, we're going to talk about CPCs now. But I just want to, as an underlying point, like where Amstrad went phenomenally wrong. This is a horrible, horrible... Look it up. It's this horrible PC. It was a 286-based PC with an EGA graphics array, which you can look it up what that means. But I think it only had about 16 colours. It was terrible. And it was a sort of a mini form factor, so in order to actually have any add-on boards, like sound cards and stuff like that, you had to take the cover off in order to have the ISA add-on boards, the sound and stuff like that. It was horrible. Poorly thought out. They didn't even bother, basically. They didn't try to have another 16-bit. They just didn't want have... They didn't even try. They just went, well, we know the IBM PC's going to be like dominant. Maybe they knew that. I don't know. They probably didn't know. But they just went, oh, let's just go with the IBM PC because we're making clones for those anyway. And I do remember that time when the IBM, everyone was starting to go, actually, the PC's going to be the dominant, because that was one of the 16 bits. It was the PC, the Amiga, and the SD. And that's hard to imagine, but that's what it was. And those three machines were the 16-bit machines. And clearly, the PC, was it really 16-bit? I don't know what it was. I don't think they knew what it was. But eventually it evolved into, you know, very, very quickly when Doom arrived. Clearly it wasn't. It was something else. But that's a story for another time. But yeah, the PC-200, you can find them still for sale. They're relatively rare, but they don't go for very much because they're junk.
They had a weird... Didn't they do something where there was a you could play Mega Drive games on?
Yeah.
There was like a console like... That was the PC. That was like the kind of Mega PC or...
Yeah, that was a regular PC, just a regular, I think it was a 386, might be wrong. It was a 386 PC with a cartridge slot for Mega Drive games.
So how did they ever manage to do that? What an incredible sort of deal to be able to strike. Like, yeah. Just logistically, I suppose Sega, they're insane, you know.
Yeah,
I remember Sega UK.
Yeah, that would probably be how they did
it.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have gone straight to Japan.
Well, they lent on a lot of the UK stuff, didn't they? For like Sega, because it was in house. We drove a lot of stuff from the UK around sort of decisions on what they were doing back in those days, because the network that was held by the UK part was really strong. But yeah, what an amazing! I would imagine that now, you know, buying a PC with a PlayStation
4 drive,
PlayStation in it or whatever. Although, obviously, leaving aside the fact that Microsoft have a console and PC, but back in the day, it was just a kind of weird, hybrid to do. Because at some point,
I remember seeing them in store shelves and like, what the funk is that?
Yeah.
Retro Asylum is sponsored by Funstock.co.uk. For all the latest gaming merchandise, such as the ZX Spectrum Vega console, the JXD Android gaming tablet, or perhaps you're after a flashback ColecoVision console, visit funstock.co.uk. And don't forget to get 5% off of your order, use the discount code ASYLUM at the checkout. funstock.co.uk.
So should we start talking about some of the games then?
Oh, yes, please.
I was just before we close, I was going to say, Chris, you're a bit like... Do you ever play Outrun? You're a big fan of Outrun, I assume, yeah?
Massive, massive fan.
So, where some people took the route, you know, left and left or right and right, some people went sort of Spectrum, Commodore to the Amiga. You went Amstrad to the ST. You took the other branches in the road.
I did take the other branches in the road. In fact, I actually went sideways for a bit, didn't I? So I went Spectrum, then Amstrad, then ST, and a Sega Master System.
Oh, I can understand.
But then eventually I stopped going off road, and I went. I went onto the Amiga because I came to my freaking senses.
Come in the end.
Bless you.
Came to my freaking senses, and to this day I now own two Amigas. One's a 1200 that's pure, and the other one's so modded it's in a tower. For God's sake.
Nice.
Go on.
The thing is, getting an Atari isn't like taking one of the other branches on the road. It's like flipping the Ferrari.
No, come on, there were some good games in the ST. Shush. Now
we'll save that for next time.
We'll save it for another time. Oids. Anyway.
Games. tell us about games.
We should, and I want to get on Chase HQ, which we've spoken about before in the 8-Bit Wars show, which you really should listen to if you haven't already. I'm talking to your audience now, not you, Bob. So, glorious looking game, fantastic arcade game where you're chasing down perps as you would. A bit like Lotus Esprit, only not quite as advanced as that glorious game. But Turbo Esprit. Anyway, so that, for me, this really showed off the Amstrad as regards to colour and what it could do, what it really could do by people who are really knew the machine and were talented with it. I do believe it's one of the better 8-bit ports of that particular game. I think it really, one thing it does is it shows the power of the colour, why colour is so important, having that depth of colour, having those bands in the row to show the perception of, you know, illusion of speed was just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. What did you guys think? Did you see pictures of it? Did you think, that looks kind of
I actually played it on, I know you lot think I watched it on YouTube. Well, yeah. I didn't. I actually got an emulator going, and I'll tell you, I can prove that I played it, because to play it, I had to type in cat,
yeah,
and then type in run, quotes, Chase HQ.
That's right, because the Amstrad was way ahead of its time, because it knew the computers in the future would just be used to view pictures of cats, so for well, type in cat.
Kind of like Midima. Yeah.
I like it, yeah. So, anyway, I had to go with this today. I reckon I played half of your list, and I'll admit that the other half of the list I looked on YouTube. But that's because some of them I couldn't get going with a keyboard. Oh. And I haven't got a joystick. But JCHQ, at first I was like, it looks really nice, but it's quite slow. And then I hit the boost.
Yeah.
And I was like, this thing can fly. This is really, like, when it goes, it's really fast.
It's extraordinary. It's like this gameplay mechanic aspect that you think, oh, it's just chugging along. No, it's chugging along for a reason. You need to hit the turbo.
Yeah.
But how did they do that?
No idea. It was awesome.
It was just awesome. But how did they do it? How did they make the machine sing so well for that particular game? It holds up so well. In my opinion, you may disagree, but I just think it's still fun. Still fun.
It's a good game, and it's like, it really does make the Commodore 64 one look completely shit.
Yes. Then again,
so does a sort of dead.
Whoa! Stop! I'm sort of putting my heart on my sleeve here, letting you have it, and you're just diving in.
Need your whole internal organs on your sleeve.
Yeah.
my friend, I've mentioned my school friend Kevin Fernane a bit because he was. The equivalent of Chris for me. He was our friend who had the Amstrad, where we all had other systems. He had the 6212, and obviously that benefited from getting, you got the speech with that, didn't you? Because any game that had speech was automatically kind of elevating itself, onto a higher level. And it was really good. I was trying to think how I would kind of view Amstrad games, and it's almost like they're kind of Lego games. They're very deliberately built looking games, and they look very distinctive, don't they? And this one actually looks lovely and plays really nicely. But yeah, having the speech as well, let's go Mr. Driver, and the other, what was the, I can't remember what the other thing, another line,
hold on man, time's up,
that was really cool. So yeah, thanks to Kevin, I was hands on. And it's good, although his walk to his house was about another 10 minutes past, like, my other mate's house. So it was a bit of an extra effort to go and play kind of Amstrad games. But I was an inclusive kid, and we did everything, and we'd go there. But then I think it's a really good conversion. We touched on it in the 8-Bit War episode, didn't we?
It's not a bad conversion at all.
But what I'm asking
is
about what your memories are at the time.
Well, at the time, I think. Everyone at school knew one Amstrad owner.
Yeah.
Whoever I speak to can get, like, gaming wise, we only knew one person, and the guy I knew, his name was Martin Gerlin. And he had a green screen, and he only had the 464. So I think I played it round there, but compared to the Spectrum version, I know this ain't 8-Bit Wars, so I don't really want to compare different versions, but
no.
it was it didn't look, you know, because I wasn't getting to see the colour, it just looked like chunkier graphics of the Spectrum version, you know, and so it was missing the menu music. But I played it a good few years later. It was at one of the first retro events that I went to, and I really enjoyed it. I was thoroughly impressed, you know. I hadn't seen it in colour up until that point, apart from in screenshots in the magazines at the time, and it's a really nice conversion.
That is really good.
So, let's move on to the next game, because we've got a little list here, and they're all awesome. So I don't want to, you know, detract from any of them. So, Enduro Racer. Looked remarkably like the Spectrum version.
In a smaller playing field.
Yeah. And it ran not quite as fast. Don't know why. Because both machines said the same CPU. But, they did. Both said 80 machines. But, I still loved it. Didn't detract from the enjoyment I got out of playing it. I eventually got the ST version. And that was actually Arcade Perfect.
Now, that's the version that I always saw in the magazines, the adverts, and that's what seeing those, they looks like the Spectrum's graphics but coloured in on ST. Let's get back to the Amstrad, because I'm changing the subject.
What else can I say? It's running mode one, and which is fine, there's nothing wrong with that, and it's I still got a lot of enjoyment out of it. The fact that I remember it was one of the few racing games, Goon Chase HQ, that I actually remastered. I got really, really good at the game. I don't know how, because it's not particularly easy, but for some reason I just got into the groove of it. I think Enduro Race is definitely a game that if you have an Amstrad, get hold of a copy of this particular one, because it shows off a lot of the machine's capabilities. Even though it's running in mode one, it doesn't detract from the animation's really good. The flow of the track is really good. It works really well.
It was a John Gage game, wasn't it? Who made it? And I think he made a lot of Amstrad. Amstrad games.
Was it John Gage?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was John Gage.
Mm-hmm. Check. Magic of Google.
Yeah.
Next one. Unless you've got anything more to say on it, I think I just don't want to. I want to rattle some off, and you can respond if you will. I think
it
would be best. Grisor, which is Contra, isn't it?
Mm. I believe. Kevin Fillane had this one as well.
Very nice looking game on the Amstrad, this.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful looking game. Absolutely stunning. Really using brilliant use of Mode Zero. Flip screen, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the...
Jones's graphics. He was the guy who done the graphics on the Amstrad port of Renegades, and I loved his work.
He
made the, you know, he really used the palette of the Amstrad
He just knew gradients, layers. He knew what to do with that palette. He's a master at it, and This game really, really, really showed it off. If you want to show off the Amstrad, want to see what it's really capable of, just get this. Have a play at this, and you'll be blown away.
Because playing that first level, you know, the bit where you go up to that initial kind of gate, it's like the arcade. Very extremely loyal. That's a cool game. This is always the first game Kevin Fillane would play when I went to his house. He had comfort around Grisor.
No, I mean, neither machine at the time could do this. Generally, just couldn't do it. That's why I included it. It would be, if I didn't, I'll get yelled at by my fellow Amstrad fans.
It had some nice music as well, I think.
With the wobbliness, but yeah.
So one question about this, and I don't know if it was true on the Speccy and the 64, but could you point your gun in different directions? Because I couldn't find the keys to do it today when I was trying to play it. I don't know if you could do it with a joystick. I don't know if you could do it on the Speccy and the Commodore either. I can't remember.
On the Spectrum, you can definitely move around direction. You know, aim in directions. Yeah. You had to press spacebar to jump.
Okay.
On the Spectrum version, I can't remember on the Amstrad.
About lying down.
Lying down. Lying down. Just was all right. Down.
Could you lie down, Steve?
I was able to lie down. I just couldn't shoot in diagonals, you know, like upwards to shoot the things coming up above me.
That's strange.
But I was just trying it out on the keyboard, and maybe if you had the joystick you could, or maybe I couldn't find the right keys.
Yeah.
Original hardware, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. Exactly.
So the next game I want to talk about is a game I have a great deal of fondness because I got it for Christmas. It's Gauntlet. I really, really wanted this game. Dropped unsubtle hints to my siblings and anyone else who's within earshot. And lo and behold, I did get it. Hooray! the thing that blew me away about this game is, again, another brilliant use of a mode zero graphics with the extraordinary colour palette. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Looked not quite arcade quality because, again, that was reserved for the ST and Amiga versions. But nonetheless, doesn't detract from the fun that that game is. Much better as a team play game. And, you know, they've relaunched this game over and over and over again, even to this day. You know, they keep on relaunching it.
Yeah.
And there's obviously something about it that people are drawn to.
It doesn't hold the charm. It doesn't hold the charm, though, does it? You know, the more modern versions of it.
No, it doesn't.
It's totally detached from...
Yeah, it just, you know, it's... Personally, I've always favoured Gauntlet 2 over 1.
Yeah.
Maybe heretical to say that, but I think there's more to Gauntlet 2. You had the dragons and stuff like that.
Probably can't shoot the food in the more modern versions as well.
Funny enough, when I was fixing the main cabinet the other day,
uh-huh.
And it's changing the subject yet again, but I had Gauntlet on while I was fixing it, and I had my head underneath.
Yeah.
And the demo mode is silent for about 3 minutes, and it goes, "Elf is about to die," and it frightened the bloody life out of me.
Warrior needs food badly.
When I was playing Diablo back in 97, remember that? When it first came out?
Yes.
Playing it online with people again, that was an innovative thing to do back then, and my warrior was called Red Warrior, and I would say things like, "Is about to die, has shot the food," stuff like that on the screen. Yes, I know, it's sad. So I was just saying, hey, Diablo's just a Gauntlet. It's not, by the way, at all. Diablo's way more than Gauntlet.
Now, at this stage, Chris, a cruel person would ask about how Gauntlet controlled.
Yeah,
and those who've listened to the 8-Bit Wars episode
already know the story. Research,
and it was my 464 at the time had a broken joystick port. Not true. The joystick port, my 464, wasn't working. Turns out it was. I've tested it since, and it works fine.
That's not as much fun.
Sadly.
Yeah. I'll edit this bit out, it's fine.
Yeah, so after 30 years, I went, right, let's test this. Oh, bollocks, I had a crap machine. So, yeah, it's 40 joystick port. What are you going to do? Yeah. So it does work perfectly fine. I do remember playing with my brother, actually, and he enjoyed this one. And when he saw a whole room full of treasure chests, he would start muttering under his breath, "Greed. Greed! And he would just go chasing after him. Like, and expensive everything, even when Death was chasing after him. By the way, the sound effects are brilliant in this game. Death especially, you have this clang.
Yeah.
Just like, and it would go on until you were, you know, he got your 200 health. That was a great game. But only in small spurts. One of the things that struck me about the game, again, I said this in the 8-Bit Wars, I'm going to say it again. There's a big presentation screen when you're selecting your character. And there's this dirty great glove the size of maybe 2.5 inches that swoops across the screen. And you can just move it. And it just is so smooth. I've never seen anything like it. It was amazing. It was just weird. Go and check it out for yourself. It's amazing to see this thing. It's beautifully detailed glove. And we spent a lot of time in it. And it's just, I don't know why, but they did. So, yeah, it's really cool. So the next game is a game that's appeared on almost everything. Whizball.
Mm.
Love this game.
Whizball appeared on Spectrum.
Well, it was a C64 game originally, wasn't it?
Yeah, I personally prefer the C64 version because it's certainly built for that machine. And I've recently played it, actually. It's fantastic. Great game. But it worked really, really well on the Amstrad as well. It did a really good job of that. It didn't do mode 1 on it, they did mode 0. So, yeah, it's a really solid port of an excellent bonkers, quite frankly, almost punishingly difficult game.
See, I had a go with this one today as well, and it looks really nice. It's got a really similar look to the C64 version.
Yeah, something about it isn't quite...
I found it hard to control. I found it really hard to control the bounce of the whiz ball himself.
Yeah, well, that's the same, yeah.
It just pings off. Like, I mean, I think on the C64, he seems to have a bit more sort of finesse in, like, how fast you spin the ball is how fast he bounces to the left and right. Yeah. Whereas on the Amstrad, he just sort of went off like a pinball point.
Yeah,
really hard to control.
Very unforgiving. Yeah. So that is a problem with it. But visually,
looks nice. Looks nice.
Great. Speaking of games looking nice and impossibly difficult games, it's quite frankly should not have been given birth to, is Ghosts and Goblins. I adored this game, but for all the wrong reasons. I remember it taking 25 minutes to load. So there you are.
It's like a C64 game.
Yeah, the board rate for the Amstrad, I should have looked this up, was pretty poor. I mean, the last V8,
that was one of my one of the games that I loved and then went back to and then just realised...
It's terrible.
Oh. it was akin to playing a game through someone's letterbox.
Yes.
The small amount of screen that was left
in
the game.
Yeah.
It's really, 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 really difficult, unnecessarily so. But anyway, that took a similar amount of time to load. Despite this, I remember having a MicroSwitch joystick, my very first one to play on this. Remember the QuickShot 2 Plus or Turbo? The one with the red base?
Yeah.
I have one of those. Which, by the way, a bit of hardware facts, in order to get it to work on an Amstrad, you have to have an Amstrad-compatible version of the joystick. If you plug in any other version of that joystick, it won't work.
So you have to look for a little kind of star on the box.
Yes. Yeah. And there's actually a switch on the back that you actually have to select to CPC 464 mode. Otherwise, it won't work. God knows why, but there it is. So, yes, I remember playing it with this. And now, we all know Ghosts and Goblins, right? We've all played it, maybe in a Capcom collection on the Amstrad, on the PlayStation, which is the arcade original. Or on various 8-bit ports.
Have the scars to show for it. I was bemoaning my ineptitude. We had the recent episode with the Sharp computer. And again, I was taunted by the game showing you the map of where you need to get to and then punishing you because you can't get over the second tombstone.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And I remember playing on the Spectrum. The Spectrum version is really good, right? It is. It's a really good port. And I'm not being patronising about that. It plays really well, and actually slightly faster and slightly more fluid than the other versions. But the Amstrad version, again, uses Modern Zero graphics. It looks fantastic. It looked great. Played like a dog. Of course it did, because it's Ghosts and Goblins. Right? I mean, I'm not a big fan of this game.
I am a big fan of the game, and I was envious of the Amstrad version, again, because it had a great soundtrack.
Yes.
David Whittaker had done, like, a remix of the arcade's music. I was really gutted that there was never a Spectrum 128K version using that music. But, yeah, the game doesn't play too well on the Amstrad, does it? It's got, like, some sort of flip-screen scrolling.
Yeah,
on the go, and when you get hit, you don't lose your armor, do you?
From memory,
I'm pretty sure you don't.
No, I do remember seeing that.
No pants.
There's no pants or the sprite doesn't change.
Huh? That I don't remember. I'd have to check, but I do remember seeing that. But then again, my memory's faded because since then I actually played the original arcade version on the Capcom collection for the PlayStation. So that's what I remember.
Yeah, I only played it recently on the Amstrad.
And it doesn't happen.
I'm pretty sure there's no pants.
Hi there, Retro Beats. It's Mike Smashy Smash here from Fab FM, and it's a pleasure to be joining the Retro Asylum team so that we can give you a rundown of the UK gaming chart from July of 1986. As July of 1986 was one of my all-time top 10 favourite times of all time. Not half. So, down 3 at 10, it's Compilation-tastic, they sold a million by the Hit Squad. Down 5 at 9, it's Tomahawk by Digital Integration. New in at 8, it's those ever-changing pesky robots in disguise, the Transformers by Ocean. Fallen 2 at 7, it's Wireframe-tastic Elite by Firebird. Up 4, it's That Sneaky Sod Saboteur by Durrell at 6. New at 5, it's For All You Cheapskates Out There, it's Spellbound by Master Tronic. Down 2 at 4, it's ER Kung Fu by Imagine. Last month's number 1 falls back 2 places. It's the Ever Macho Commando by Elite Systems. There's another Muscle Bound 0 for 2. Yes, old Dice Stallone is straight in there with Rambo by Ocean. And new in at number 1, it's Winter Games by US Gold. However, we don't like national anthems, so let's rewind back to number 3 and listen to the macho-tastic music of Commando. Retro Asylum is sponsored by funstock.co.uk. For all the latest gaming merchandise such as the ZX Spectrum Vega console, the JXD Android gaming tablet, or perhaps you're after a flashback ColecoVision console, visit funstock.co.uk. And don't forget to get 5% off of your order, use the discount code ASYLUM at the checkout. funstock.co.uk.
Next game, then, is Akari Warriors. Again, this is a game called 8-Bit Wars. Again, this is a Christmas game I got. I adored this game. We've got the loading screen for it, which you can find on the internet.
Homoerotic.
Yes, homoerotic. Very, very odd. Drawn by a 12-year-old, maybe even. He was blindfolded.
In the closet.
Yeah. And... yeah, very, very poor loading screen. But the game itself, again, the Mode Zero game, I clearly prefer those. In fact, most of the games, in fact, the rest of the games we're talking about are all Mode Zero. There you go. So I love that colour palette. It's one of the reasons I got the machine, is because of that extraordinary colour palette. And music was good. The sound effects were okay. I love the fact that the when you threw a grenade, the animation for that, where everything you blew up. And it was just so... It created cascade effects where... You blew up one thing, and then something else blew up, and something else blew up. It was just so much fun, and I played it for a very, very, very long time. It worked really well as a one-player game as well as a two-player game. The action of jumping into a tank and just, you know, driving up the screen and killing everyone in sight within, you know, until you had to get out because you ran out of road. It's awesome. Really, really good stuff.
But this, I mean, I had a look at this one on YouTube today. I didn't play this one, but this had decent scrolling as well. Which shows that the Amstrad could do it if it wanted to.
Yeah, if you could push it hard enough.
Yeah,
people knew what they were doing. It could scroll really well. You know, it didn't need to do
flip screen.
But it all depends on the talent involved. I don't think this game would have worked at all as a flip screen game. So probably were forced into squeezing that aspect out of it, otherwise it would have been, you know.
Well, it might have been that because it was scrolling upwards rather than sideways.
But it's an interesting point of note. At the time, I never played any other version of this. Okay, so I did not know the Spectrum or the C64 versions.
Well, the Spectrum version, as we mentioned on the 8-bit ones, is by the same programmer. It plays virtually identically, apart from, you know, the lack of... It's obviously got lack of colour. Now, you mentioned about the scrolling. I'm pretty sure that... Have you ever played Who Dares Wins on the Amstrad?
No.
That's a very similar game to Akari Warriors. I'm pretty sure, going by memory, I'm pretty sure that was flip screen scrolling.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. I might be wrong.
I'd get the fear playing that, because my life, kind of the bane of your life, is flip screen games where you just die when you get to the...
Yeah, walk into a bullet, like, oh, great, thanks. So, that's Akari Warriors, one of my favourites. Again, one you should check out. It still holds up for the most part, but it does get a bit, you know, there is a sense of progression in the game. You do get to see more and more things, like Xevious and stuff like that. It's fine. So the next game I've got, which is again a game we've spoken about, but the last four are pretty much unique to the Amstrad, so I just thought to save the best till last. Although Exelon isn't. But anyway, Renegade. Fantastic.
Sorry.
Since Windows 10 started working again.
No.
Fantastic beat 'em up, sort of, well, it's a side-scrolling action adventure beat 'em up, isn't it, really? I have played it recently. Still holds up. Still really good, really, really, really good fun. I understand that there are aspects of the gameplay which didn't exist in the Amstrad version. It did exist in the 128 version of the Spectrum, but we're not here to regurgitate that. We're here to talk about the Amstrad version, and that's what I'm going to do. And it's one of the last games I bought and played on the Amstrad. Because it was the, for me, it was a swan song for the machine before I sold it on. And I actually sold my Amstrad on the strength of this game. Someone came round and I said, this is what the Amstrad can do. Oh, that's amazing. I will buy it. It will work out.
Cool, that was time. Was that, must have been about 88, 89, 88, yeah. Something like that,
Renegade,
I think.
87.
That's right, because that's when I bought my ST, it was 87. So, yeah, really, really good game. If you can get hold of it, do. Interesting fact, for some reason, because it was so realistic, the colour popped out so well, that there was a strange censorship they added to the game where the colour of the blood when you took someone out was blue. So it wasn't blood, it was sweat or something, they said. So that was a bit peculiar. But it was very vivid, bright blue. I remember seeing that.
Couldn't you do a key press? You could do a key press to activate the blood.
There was, I believe, but I just never bothered with it.
Yeah, the reason it was actually blue was because the game was shipped in Germany because of the CPC being fairly popular over in Germany and in France. And the Germans do not like that sort of thing in their games.
No.
They are still like that now.
Yeah.
They are. Yeah,
exactly. The Australians as well. Australians.
Yeah. Well, Commando was changed, wasn't it, for its release in Germany? I think he was a robot instead of a soldier.
Or
he's fighting aliens, something like that. They'd rather aliens get shot than humans.
Yeah.
That's acceptable.
Well, I mean, that's something we still have to check in Sony now when I work. It's like, when we're checking stuff for German things, it's like, can it have blood? No. Can't see a swastika in a game. Brutal violence. It's all like gotta be like, if it's being released in Germany, you have to check it for that. So they're still doing that same thing, like, even to this day.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, carry on. Sorry. So go on, Chris.
So the Sacred Armor of Antiriad. That's what it was, I believe it was called anyway. This was a game that came out on the other machines as well. So
I was going to say it's Palace, wasn't it?
Mm. But again, the Mode Zero game, so all the palette colour popping out, all that stuff was in effect. Fantastic. I remember this game being phenomenally difficult yet engrossing, so I really liked the storyline and the idea that it's set in a post-apocalyptic world thousands of years after, you know, things have happened, and there's this big armour that you have to put on to fight against aliens and stuff. It was cool. It was really, really a good game. Action adventure game. It's quite a deep and engrossing and multifaceted game. So yeah, definitely one to try out. What do you lot think?
Well, I know it's got the good cool music. Richard Joseph did the music for it,
right?
And that was good. But that's the limit of when I used to go to play at other people's houses, that you'd never get down to playing a particularly long game, so you just do the quick hit stuff. I'm obviously aware of the game, but not on the Amstrad, but on other systems.
Yeah,
I mean, I had a look at this one today, and I thought it's got a brilliant loading screen. Fantastic, and then graphic style is fantastic as well. The animation of the main character is brilliant. Even his like hair blows in the wind.
It's amazing.
It's fantastic. Really, yeah, really good. And then go on.
I remember getting into the armour for the first time. That was pretty cool.
Well, is that the point where the hood powers up?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was cool as well. Like, really nice graphics, the way that like sort of powers up and there's a little screen in the middle. Mm. Really nice looking game. Really nice.
So, yeah, that's a game that you should definitely check out and holds up to this day. It's one of those games where, like, hey, I should finish that, you know? With your current mindset, with your current skill set, of playing games after all this time.
Yeah.
I'll probably be way better at it now than I was back in the day.
Well, it looked like it had quite a lot of depth to it.
It does. That's the thing. So I like those games now more than ever. I appreciate them now more than ever. Get Dexter. This is unique to the Amstrad. It was a French game. How can I put it? It's an isometric action-adventure game with lots of puzzles, beautifully animated, brilliant use of the colour palette again. And how can I put it? It's a really engrossing isometric action-adventure game of which there were many back in the day. If you remember, there was Movie. Do you remember that game?
And yep.
There was a whole bunch of them that came out that were quite deep and complex.
Head Over Heels and all that kind of.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. You know, and Batman.
Yeah.
They're kind of same stock, really. Same kind of genre. Same kind of branch of the tree, if you will, of action-adventure games. Would highly recommend it. It's a bit odd, a bit weird, a bit French, but it doesn't detract from its entertainment value.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I mean, I thought it looked really nice. I mean, these aren't my type of game. I don't really like open-worldy type where you've got to remember stuff. Like puzzles and all that kind of thing, go into that room and turn that on and go back in the other room, drives me mad. But gotta say, I mean, it looked fantastic again, like loads of detail in each of the rooms, like really like creative level design.
Like Fairlight as a game, it's like as well.
Yeah,
it's quite a claim. Yeah. A lot of people say that this game is, you know, up there, if not better than the kind of classic sort of Ultimate games. Whether that's a challenge that is not a game that I played, but what would you?
Oh, you meant? Did you say Ultimate?
Yeah, Ultimate.
Sorry, I thought you said Ultimate.
Oh, not Ultimate. The Ultimate game, because there were a bit kind of Marmite isometric view games, because some people just don't get on with that kind of view. I obviously like all the sort of classic Ultimate games, but where would you sort of put this one against those, Chris?
I wouldn't, because those are different types of games, I believe. I think there's two tranches of isometric view games. There's the Ultimates, have their own unique gameplay mechanic and style to them, that are unique to them and separate to them, and they're Ultimate games, you know, Night Law, Alienate, and Pentagram, and you know, all of those are unique. They have that style to them, and I want to put this Get Dexter alongside games like Movie and Suivo's World,
right,
and stuff like that. I think they're a different. They're more of an adventure game. They're more about solving puzzles and adventure game. Whereas I found the Ultimate games had their own unique style to them that were more about dexterity and skill, because the people who really conquered Night Law and Alien 8, I can only speak for myself for Alien 8, I didn't conquer Night Law, I did conquer Alien 8, and it has a bitterly disappointing ending. Really does. Don't know if you played it,
unless
you finished it, but it has a terrible, terrible ending.
No spoilers.
No, but it's bloody awful. I was absolutely incensed when it happened.
It was a spoiler, Chris. Just tell us.
No, I'm not going to do it.
Okay, okay.
It's an Ultimate game. If I did that, you'll really get hate mail. But those people who know, listening to the show, finish that game, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But I think they were more dexterity-based. They rewarded players with skill. They did. Whereas the other games like Get Dexter and stuff like that rewarded player with more grey matter or puzzle solving skills, and that's great. That's the reason why we love games so much, because they cater for all different types, which leads me on, if I may go on to the next game, is Trailblazer. Now this game appeared on a plethora of machines, and some people loved it, some people loathed it. I don't know, it's not a Marmite game. Sometimes I was really in the mood for it, and I got into the flow of it, and it's one of those games where this was purely skill-based, and that you had a little football, don't know why, on a coloured rotating track, which didn't change direction, but just had gaps in it, didn't it?
Yeah.
So dirty great gaps, which you had to somehow navigate, right? And again, a Mode Zero game, so it looked fabulous. Fabulous on the Amstrad. What do you guys think?
It was just so difficult. Yeah, yes. That's what I remember from Trailblazer. It was just a really hard game, and I never really got on with it. And I don't even think my brother, because he generally kind of, I'd hand stuff over to him, and he'd get on with it. I don't even think he played. That's what it was one of those things where it was a bit something of a technical marvel because of the kind of depth of field and way that the things that it was doing. But it was almost like they were shooting for that over something that you get a huge amount of enjoyment out of. That for me anyway, at age 11, whatever old I was when it was out.
You see, I liked this back in the day. I liked it almost on the Commodore 64.
Oh. Yeah.
Then I came
it
back
ran
to it
really, really well on the C64.
Well, this is the point though, you see, because I came back to it recently, and it's stupidly fast to the point, like Paul says there, that it's too hard to do anything, because by the time you've seen a gap or what you're supposed to do, you've already crashed. Yeah. Looking and having a quick go at the Amstrad one today, it's actually more playable because it's not as fast. Yeah. It's still fast. It's still a fact, it's by no means sluggish, but it's at a right pace to actually get a bit of a chance to like jump over the gaps or move left and right and dodge them. And I also like the fact that on the Amstrad one, the track folds underneath the screen, sort of rolls off. Yeah, it doesn't do that on the Commodore. On the Amstrad. Well, I don't know about the spec.
No, I don't think it didn't either.
It's a little fold, and that's where the palette comes in.
Looks really nice.
You have different shades of green and yellow as it went under. It's fabulous.
It looks like Klax. Remember Klax, the Tetris one? It's got the similar look, except similar obviously look. It's fast.
Yeah, very fast. But
I'm impressed with it. Really impressed with it.
Yeah, good game. Really good game. And bringing about difficulty, I had this discussion on Facebook the other day about someone saying, oh, this game, well, this series of games is rock hard. I said, yes, difficulty is something that developers, to this day, still can't. They're really good at it now, but back then, didn't have a clue.
No.
You know, playtesting was beyond their comprehension. Like, no, we've got to get this game out. Can we playtest this? No, we don't. Whereas now, even though in these Dark Souls post-times, but that's, there are games that revel in their difficulty, but they don't punish the player. They're not unfair. Because I was talking to the developer the other day on my show, that the key about a game, a really good game, is not... It has to be fair. Not about being fun, because, some games aren't technically fun, because that's a discussion for another time. It's about being fair. If a game is punishing, and it's the fault of the design, not the player, then the game is bad. It's badly designed. And we encountered that back in the day, but we never spoke in that kind of language. We never said the phrase, this game is badly designed. I don't remember it ever being said. You know, it's just the concept of designing a game. Like, what? You made it, but to design it? That kind of phraseology didn't happen until the PlayStation era, in my opinion.
Well, I don't think that anyone in those days thought about how long does this game last? Outside of an adventure game, you get a fair idea. But anything else, it's not like now where someone will just put in content or put something to it, because it's about how long that game lasts, because people criticise if a game's short now, even though some of the most enjoyable current games games are actually comparatively short. Journey being a really good example, but back then I just don't think they were motivated that way. But games were, look at something like Rick Dangerous. I mean, that was just intentionally that would just kill you because it wanted to kill you, not because you did something
kind
wrong.
Sadomasochistic.
I just want to correct you there, but raise a point. Rick Dangerous, and with many of these other games we've been talking about, not so much Trailblazer, but definitely this next game we're going to talk about definitely falls under this category. And I was going to say definitely again, if you like, which I just did. But it's about memory puzzles. Rick Dangerous is a memory puzzle game. Definitely.
Yeah.
It's all it is. You just know, okay, don't go over that bit. Why? Because spikes appear. How do I know that? Well, you know that because that happened to you last time. But I can't see it now. I know you can't. But you know it's going to happen if you go into that space. But there's no indicator to tell me those spikes appear. I know.
No.
But you know it happens. Because it happened to you last time. Do you see? And it's just like, that's it's bad. it's just as bad. But, you know, games like Super Meat Boy got away with it. Why? Because, A, you immediately respawned after you died. Just immediately. Bang. Okay, have another go. Now you know what to do. Have another go. Now you know what to do. Have another go. And it's just, that's how you get over it. You make it fair. You just make it fair. And Trailblazer wasn't fair. And Whizball wasn't fair. Right? And that's what we've learned. That's what game development, that's why I'm, as much as I'm a big fan of retro games, I love modern games too.
But I say, I mean, I think back in the day, we were tougher as gamers. We were tougher. And I think in this day and age now, games just hold your hand. They literally go, do you want to play it on easy? There's easy. I'm going to explain every single bit of the game to you as you go along.
Then it goes,
do you want to save here? Do you want to save here? Do you want to save here? Do you want to go back like 10 seconds? You know, and it's like, back in the day, we, like you just said there about Trailblazer and other games that were tough, you wouldn't go to yourself, that's been designed, that's too hard, that. Your mate would just go, you're crap at that.
Yes, that would be it. It would be your fault.
You're crap at that. You're going to have to get better.
Yeah, rather than, well, it's bad design. And that's the kind of technology, that's what, because it is. See, it is bad design.
I think
you know?
That there are some games, like retro games, that could have done with tutorials.
They could have done with a manual.
Gift to the Gods by Ocean.
Hang on.
Frankie Goes to Hollywood, did anyone have a clue what was going on in those games?
No. If you read the instruction manual, then you would actually know. For example,
it's an instruction manual. It's a one-page inlay on a cassette. I mean, it's...
Right.
Yeah, they didn't come with instructions a lot of games did. And anyway, games by Ocean. Different. You open the case up. It was a big blurb on the story. But when it comes to the actual game itself, it didn't really give a great deal away, did it?
No, it'd tell you how the joystick worked and how to load the tape.
Yeah, and who programmed it.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. I don't know. There's some games that were released at the time that did have quite voluminous amounts of information on the manual which none of us read. Anyway.
Or there was a game, like, I think it was Rastascan, that we did a feature on some of the Pickford's games, and that one they freely admitted that they put a load of blurb that made no sense on the bottom. They didn't put any explanation on what you did with that game, and the fact that we finished it was more out of bloody mindedness than anything, and then the zero sense of achievement at the end of that. But there were games that people would talk about, the V game, I think, was one of the ones that we've spoken before, where you'd say to people, did you play it? I couldn't get out of the room. I couldn't get out of the first room. It looked really good, but I couldn't get out of the first room.
Yeah, the first room, no idea what I was doing, yeah.
But this is a hangover from the arcades as well, though.
Yes.
As we've come into the early 80s and the arcade generation, when that's all that game designers were really making at first, was just arcade rip-offs.
Because they didn't know any better.
Yeah, they didn't know any better, and arcades were just built to beat you.
Yeah.
It just wanted more money off you, so they were built, you can play for 2 minutes, but then we're just going to kill you.
The Retro Asylum podcast show is sponsored by RetroTowers.co.uk. Are you after a new joypad, or maybe some new leads for your console, or maybe even an EverDrive cartridge? If so, check out RetroTowers.co.uk. For a 5% discount, use the discount code RetroAsylum at the checkout. That's RetroTowers.co.uk.
Join the fun right now and chat with other retro maniacs. Visit theRetroAsylum.com or on Twitter at RetroAsylum1. Get involved now!
For Exelon.
Tell us about Exelon.
Last game. A fantastic arcade, I think arcade adventure, but I'm going to go with just arcade shooting game with a little soldier who's armed with missiles and a gun. And punishingly difficult, would repeatedly kick you in the rear end for doing what sounds like a reasonable thing to do, but then just out of sheer bloody mindedness and bad luck, you would actually die. I know it's on many, many different machines, but on the Amstrad, again, it's saying it was built for it because it was, on all the machines, it was a flip screen title.
From
left to right. It's really good. Really well animated, well, great sound, great music. It's good stuff. Really good. But then again, it's Houston Consultants. They really delivered quality games. I remember playing Runner-Armor, and that was a fantastic game on the ST. But I'd left the 8-bits by then when that came out. But I know it was on the 8-bits as well, but I played on the ST. But no, Exelon, a beautiful-looking game. Again, another mode. Signing off with yet another Mode Zero game. I just love the Mode Zero games on the Amstrad. They really show machine off. Some may disagree, but I just really do. And Exelon is one of my favourites, even though I've yet to beat it to this day.
It's always up there. The first thing I think about is in the walking animation stakes.
Yes.
This is one of the one of the games which the Dean's going to talk about, Robocop walking upstairs. In a minute, I can tell. I can tell by his face. But just that animation and the deliberate nature of the movement of the character is really memorable.
Yeah, very good.
It looked really cool.
To be honest, sounds like another 8-bit Wars thing again, but this was a Spectrum game that was then converted to the Amstrad. Mm. But you're right, it had its graphics totally redrawn for the Amstrad, and it works really well. Did you ever play Cybernoid? 1 and 2, they were by the same programmer, and they were nice on the Amstrad as well. You'd like those, Chris.
I did play Zynaps. That's a great game.
Yeah.
Bad collision detection though in that game. Very bad. Still good. Still a good game though. But that's the design.
Well, the Cybernoid games were by the same programmer as Exelon, and very similar feel.
Right.
Really worth checking out on the Amstrad. Very, very nice games indeed.
So there's my selection. It's not, there are many others. In fact, I culled this list down because there were more on there. But I wanted to, you know, finish this podcast in a reasonable amount of time. I could have talked about Asphalt, for example, which is a crazy French game where you're driving along the road, a highway, and defending raiders that are trying to take down a petrol tanker that you're driving along in a post-apocalyptic world. That's kind of cool. There's many, many other games. The Amstrad... we did sort of hint of it earlier on the show how it was the forgotten machine. People
why do you think that was? Do you think it was because it was simply released later than the other two, you know, the Spectrum and the C64? Or
yes, I think its late release didn't help it. I think the fact that it was by Amstrad didn't help it. And it was just it was the unknown. It felt like a Me Too machine. But to counter that, clearly people bought them. I know I did. I defected. And it had an audience, so much so that all the major publishers released games for it. I mean, you could see advert for Ocean, and they would have, you know, the three prices of the games. You know, Spectrum was £1 cheaper because for some reason Spectrum owners were cheapskates, whereas everyone else had to pay a little bit extra.
The thing is though, Chris, it sounds like, again, I'm backtracking and I'm just trying to knock the machine. I'm not, because I own it and I really do enjoy it now. But I think the problem was a lot of the publishers would have only have published the Amstrad version because they could port the Spectrum version across cheaply, because there's no two ways about it. It was the system that lacked popularity, and it didn't sell as well as the other two machines.
I think not in this country it didn't, no.
No, in France it's very popular.
France and Spain and Germany, it really sold exceptionally well. And I think that is why. That's really the reason why the publishers were catering to it. It wasn't so much for the UK audience, but the continental European.
Yeah, I think as time went on, especially, during the early 90s, when 8-bit systems started to die away in the UK, I think there was still, especially in France, the machines were doing really well. And that's why, we've got some issues of Amstrad Action here, and one of them is a 1994 issue. Now, I know the crash and, your Sinclair definitely didn't go that far into the 90s, they made it to about 91, 92, and then they died because the Spectrum market just wasn't there anymore.
I mean, it was a clever thing to, because with the Amstrad, it was getting the monitor as well. Yeah. So it was a good idea to be able to kind of rid that, sort of take away the TV as the place that you're going to play stuff. But maybe the fact it was just there were just more TVs and kids had that other telly rather than at the beginning of the life of the certainly the Spectrum. There was a, you know, you'd either have like a really rubbish black and white job or you'd very occasionally be able to sort of plug it into the big telly. I suppose
that was the big fight, wasn't it? It was just like, I need a telly for the computer. Well, we're watching Coronation Street.
Yeah.
Can I just want to play Manic Miner? No one wants to watch you play a Manic Miner.
No.
7 o'clock. Go away. Like, and it's just, yeah, you're right. And the fact the Amstrad came with its own telly was a good thing.
And it is. And clearly you should go, what was the launch price of it? A couple of hundred quid, wasn't it?
No, it was quite expensive. It was about 300 quid. Machine, yeah.
It was about 300 quid?
Release, probably dearer. I'd say about $450.
Yeah.
Which is going to have it against, which has it against it.
Yeah,
as well,
because it came with the monitor, you know, it was more pricey. But as you say,
it was a glorious monitor.
A lot of people probably thought, yeah, at least I don't lose the TV. You know, the kids can just play on this and do their homework because, you know, all parents only bought them for homework.
They did, yeah.
But, the other thing with the Amstrad that always got me was, like, with the Spectrum, you had Spectrum Target games which were like, you know, Manic Miner was really written for the ZX Spectrum, Horus Goes Skiing. And then on the C64 you had a lot of the Epix games which were originally C64 exclusives. With the Amstrad, I mean, you did get exclusives, but they weren't as hyped or as big,
no,
were they? You know?
No, they weren't. They were, certainly in the UK anyway, it wasn't as placed in the pedestal
you had
like the other
Roland's in the caves and
oh yeah, the exclusive games initially
were by Amstrad.
And they
got ported. I think in a world where we consider what you get ported to, we're talking about Sinclair and like sort of, and Commodore, rather than I think some of the Amstrad games did go onto other systems.
Again,
but yeah, I mean for the small minded of us, I suppose. Kind of,
but I'm just looking at it from all sides, you know. Mm-hmm. It is very much the forgotten system, and I know even in Retro Gamer magazine, Darren Jones, the editor of the magazine, is a friend of mine, and he often gets knocked for not featuring enough Amstrad, although he's an Amstrad fan himself. Mm-hmm. And to me, I can see more Amstrad screenshots in that than there are Spectrum, but you know, the Amstrad guys do moan and say, well, why didn't you feature the Amstrad version of this and that?
I think that's false. I mean, this month they have a panel just about the 464, double page spread just on the 464.
Yeah.
Just random, like, there you go, here's a bone for you. And it's great, you know, it's okay, yeah, 464. And then found out things about it that even I didn't know. But it's really cool. So, yeah, that's pretty much it for my selection of games for the Amstrad. And I appreciate the feedback on your perception of it. And it sounds like it has changed slightly because now you've been exposed to it personally and played games on it for yourself.
Yeah, there's some versions of the games that are definitely better than the Spectrum versions, at least. And, well, there's some games, such as Chase HQ, obviously, is a lot better on the Amstrad than it is on the C64. Yeah, it's a decent machine. I like it. You know, I've gone out and bought a GX4000. So,
yeah,
know,
it must
I'm
be
not
something,
totally
yeah.
out. Anti-Amstrad,
I think it deserves its place on the pantheon of the three of the 8-bit machines. It definitely does. It stood up to scrutiny. It really did. And as we demonstrated in the 8-bit war show, which keep on referring to, but it's worthy of people's time.
Indeed.
Awesome. So before we start rounding up, guys, Chris, do you want to tell us about the magazines? I know Dean and Paul, you've got some Amstrad magazines there, haven't you?
Yeah, we've got Amstrad Action here, which was by Future Publishing, which for me was probably the main one I remember seeing. There was another one, wasn't there, by Newsfield.
So Antics was what I read. I didn't read Amstrad Action. Antics was what I read. And because I had defected from the Spectrum, I thought, well, it's okay. There's still a Newsfield publication called Antics. Awesome. I'll read that instead. Which is exactly what I did. It's full-on defection. It's like, okay, drop, crash, and go to Antics. And it was just a straight, you know, mirror of the other two magazines. But for the Amstrad.
So was Antics, Antics was the equivalent of Crash and Zap?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's funny and it's quirky and it was interesting.
Quirky,
and
little portraits, all
it,
there.
It just didn't last for long, though, did it?
No, because the Amstrad lack of appeal. But what happened to Antics, two things happened to Antics, which is quite amusing. Well, the first one was amusing. The second one was like, that's horrible. I remember it happening and I was quite sad when it did. And it happened just as I stopped using the Amstrad, because I got the Antics from very early on. It might have been the fourth edition of the fourth issue of the magazine. Its logo had a metallic sheen to it, full on metallic, looked fabulous, really bling. And then they changed it to the same as the Crash and Zap 64 with the same sort of washed out sort of plain colour. The abuse Newsfield got over that was phenomenal. It is just, it went on and on. It just wouldn't shut up. We readers wouldn't shut up about what have you done to the logo? What have you done? Why have you done this? What? It was brilliant. Because it basically, what it did is it reinforced the view that the Amstrad was just slightly different to the other two.
Mm.
It was different. You know, it was different enough to say, you know, let's give Amtechs a different logo. Let's give it a different sort of treatment because it's the Amstrad. It's different. So let's just give this metallic glow to it. And it looked great. And then for some reason, Mr. Frey went, nah, let's just go to the plain colour thing. Oh, the furore, the abuse. It was just, you know, if it was social media existed back then, it would have been abuse full on. Just, you know, memes all over the place. It would have been horrific.
But it did look different with that kind of airbrushy sort of horizon type look to it. Yeah.
Metallic sort of like glint. Fabulous. But they got rid of it. I don't know why they did, but they did. But the second thing that happened was the sad thing that happened. Newsfield declared that Antics would be no more. And I was like, oh God, no, don't do this. And now we're going to sell it to Future, who then absorbed it into Amstrad Action. So Antics did live on, but in the pages of Amstrad Action. And I begrudgingly started reading Amstrad Action because, quite frankly, that was the only magazine left dedicated to the machine. So I was kind of forced into it, but I begrudged it. I didn't like it. Didn't have the same charm. Didn't have the Oliver Frey artwork on the front. It didn't have it, any of that.
It's a very dull-looking magazine, flicking through it now. I mean, it's by Future, who done... well, they took over Your Sinclair after Dennis sold off the rights to them.
They did, yeah.
And I don't know if it's because maybe Amstrad owners were generally a little bit older, but it seems to be more business software in a lot of it, anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know, just the actual... The way it looks just seems to be very dull. And...
Yeah, towards the end of the Amstrad's life, there was a lot of focus on EPROMs.
Yeah.
Erasable programmable ROMs. There was a lot of focus on that towards the end of its life, which is the bread and butter for BBC machines. But again, that's a discussion for another time.
Mm.
But yeah, they were really focused on that towards the end of the Amstrad's life. And people were modding it heavily to bring it up to speed to compete against the encroaching 16-bit machines, which is a fool's errand, because the only way to do that is to get rid of the Amstrad and replace it with a 16-bit processor. But people didn't want to let go of these machines because they so much affection towards them, and rightly so, as we've demonstrated in the show. At least I hope we have.
I think we have. And so the last sort of step in the Amstrad life then was the... Is it the PC 2000 that you told? 200 before?
200, yeah. It was kind of a hybrid between the Spectrum and the CPC. It was just like, okay, well, we're going to make a 16-bit machine to rival the ST and the Amiga. no, you're not. And but I think taking a little bit of a step back, I think the plus machines were really the twilight years for the Amstrad CPC, and I think it went out really well. You know, I think they were really well built machines towards the end, despite the belt problem. You know, my floppy drives that I use on my machines still work, thanks to the belt replacement. But the heads themselves are fine. You can't say the same about PlayStations now, can you? With their laser heads. Hmm. So, you know, the build quality, although cheap, still
works.
Still works. I've never actually used a Plus, I don't think. I don't think I have. I might have lied about that because I might have played it on an expo of some sort. Who knows? Considering how many I go to. But personally, I've never owned one, but I can't vouch for them. But I think they're just as well built as the older ones, maybe even better.
So just before we round up then, Chris, what if you were to recommend to any of our listeners that haven't ever owned one, what's the one to go out and get? Secondhand.
The easiest one and the best one that I would get hold of is the 6128. Definitely. They're very, very, very common. I think they made slightly more of those than they did with the 464s in the end. And you can just get a keyboard and you can get a separate power supply solution, which is now freely available on eBay. It has a separate power pack and it has a SCART cable. You can just plug it into any, even LCD TVs. It works fine. So yeah, definitely a 6128, because you then get the floppy drive. You then get the flexibility of loading games onto tape. Yes, I would definitely recommend one of those, because there's some games out there that were only released for 128 machine. Not many, but some. And I remember Roadrunner was a game that was released on the Amstrad, and it required the 128 to produce sound. I seem to remember. that would be the one to go for. Else, I would try a 464. Possibly a Plus if you can find them. But yeah, and if you do go for a 464, I would highly, highly recommend that you get a floppy disk drive. Most of the games that you can download from the internet are not on tape format. They're on disk format. Don't know why. Just the way the cookie crumbled, I guess. Very, very few tape images are out there on the internet for Amstrad games. They're mainly floppy disk images.
Fantastic.
So be wary of that.
Brilliant.
Or buy a GX4000 and a game that you can start by just hitting a fire button.
Yeah, yeah. Because there is an SD drive for it now. So yeah,
they only released about 25 games for that thing, by the way.
With the flash card, you can actually load up Amstrad games on it. You know, normal Amstrad games, as long as you could start them by just pressing fire.
Yeah,
and yet they don't require a keyboard. Otherwise, you're stuffed.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I think it's funny for me. It takes someone to have been there to be able to open your eyes to something, because, you know, as an owner of a competitor system, and I was never, you know, we didn't have the money to have more than one system, so you would be wedded to it, as opposed to these days where people will have multiple systems and PCs and stuff. The answer is quite a charming system that clearly has a lot of. Yeah, there's a lot of invested in them by the people who had them at the time, and whenever Chris comes on, he's extremely, you know, it comes across how impassioned you are about, you know, just saying, just give it a go in some way, try and get access to it, and then play it, and then make your mind up that way, rather than just kind of dismissing it as the third system. I always see it as it's and Amstrad, you know, that's where you'd sort of think about games.
I seem to be the champion for the lesser-known systems, generally. I do it with the Intellivision all the frickin' time.
Mm. And I think it's important that there is that, because, you know, as a podcast or website, the fruit doesn't fall far from the tree sometimes. So you can just get into that frame of mind where you're talking about the things that you're most familiar with. So it's really good that, Chris, that you can come on and you can fill that, you know, you can fill that gap for us. And I think it does prompt people to go and look and go and see. You know, there were other games that you had on the list that I played on, you know, especially someone like, you know, even someone like Cauldron, that I had never played on ever. And the actual you know, the interest of actually going to play a game that I've never played on another system is enough for me to be able to go seek it out. So, yeah, when you're right about the 128, that's the one to go for. Just like absolutely, anyone buying a Spectrum, yeah, you buy a plus two. You know, you're not going to miss out on any games by having that, you know, going and getting that version. So, yeah.
And well, oddly enough, I do play on my 48 Bubba Key more. I don't know why. I just play a lot of games, 8K games. So I end up, when I'm playing 48K games, then I'm on the rubber keys. It's weird.
I think with the earlier games, it's, you know, Jetpack and stuff like that on the Spectrum, I tend to go for the rubber key model.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I'm using a joystick. For some reason, this is like, oh, when I'm on
that
little...
case, you've got no excuse.
I've got no excuse.
Just the framing of it, it just feels better.
Just the framing, feels better. It's like, that's how it was back in the day, so that's how I'm going to play it.
Fantastic. Okay, well, I mean, Chris, I mean, I just want to sort of repeat what Dave said, because we've talked about doing an Amstrad episode quite a few times, haven't we, guys?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's good to actually finally get around to doing it and to have someone on who's properly passionate about it as well. And that's, like, you know, like Paul just said there, that's really come across. I mean, just for this podcast itself, like, I've had a look at, played some of those games just on emulator. But I've had my eyes opened as well. It's like, you know, like Paul said there, you do get sort of stuck in your own mould of, like, you know, they're specky, I'm Commodore 64, and that's your default go-to system. And it's nice to sort of be pulled out of the comfort zone sometimes and just open your eyes and go, do you know what? That version, that game is so much better on a different system, and in these types, in this instance, on the Amstrad. So, you know, I just want to say cheers for coming on, Chris, and giving us this opportunity to sort of talk to our listeners and let them hear about just how great a system it is.
Yes, it's been fun. It always is fun to come on your show.
The door's always open.
Well, I think, like we said before, we may be revisiting the 8-bit wars.
Yes.
Round two.
You put the gloves back on for that one.
Yes.
The gloves coming back on.
I'm up for that.
Yeah, I'm in. Count me in.
Same roster then. I'm doing Amstrad.
We're all back in our own corners.
Because we can switch. It's cool. It'd be awesome to, like, one of us, like, you know what? I'm going to do ZC4 and one of you do the Amstrad. It'd be quite fun.
Well, none of us care who loses then.
Yeah, but the problem with that is the listeners go, no, we want the same boxers and the same ring.
Oh, yeah, good. They know who we are.
Yeah. unless someone wants to do that thing like Rocky did, he fought, you know, he switched halfway through, switched to Southpaw halfway through the fight, so he kind of go one side and then suddenly Dean keeps talking about how much he loves the C64.
I love all three systems. Yeah. I think
so do I.
Seriously,
we're lucky that we've got three that are able to be talked about in such terms, you know, these many years after.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, what are you gonna be the ringmaster again? What's the
What's the plan? Yeah, I would get the most flack then, I think. I think so. At the end of the day,
say ringmaster, you were more like in Dean's corner behind him, squeezing his shoulders and spraying water in his mouth. But
as long as that's all he's spraying in my mouth. Well,
it's just a mental image that you don't want.
Okay, always lower the tone.
Yeah. It was funny because the first time we did it, it was more of a kind of judge. But I think we've got it out of our system now. We can be a lot more objective going forward. But yeah, it's just good fun talking about games anyway. At the end of the day, yeah,
it was a funny episode. Can we?
It was good. So, Chris, you're coming back for that, yeah?
I am indeed. Yes.
Excellent. Okay, Jen. So should we start rounding up then? Chris, have you got any shout outs? Anyone you'd like to say hello to, or?
Yeah, can I plug? Sorry, but I just want to plug my show because I'm here and I thought I'd plug mine. I have a show called The Sausage Factory. It is not in any way retro at all, for the most part. I interview video game developers about their games that they've just released or about to release. And I've got 64 episodes up now. And I'm recording another 6 over the next few weeks now. So if you want to listen to developers talk about themselves and their careers, and then talk about the games they've made and the design decisions they've made, why they went one way rather than another, check it out. It's on iTunes. It's on. You can go to spong.com and just download it directly from there. And have a listen. It's different. It's not a 4-hour marathon about hamburgers that, you know, Giant Bomb have been doing for decades. But what this show is, it's normally about 45 minutes, maybe no more than an hour, usually. Depends on the verbosity of the guest and how interesting they've got stuff coming out of their mouths. But it's just really a show about game makers and what they how they make their games.
Are you sure it's only 45 minutes long?
Yes.
You took 45 minutes to introduce yourself for this one.
I'm now done. Thank you.
To talk about making, we always make people welcome.
You're always welcome here, Chris.
We wonder why people never come back.
I'll just come in half hour late.
Sorry, you're right. I did
that. I'm joking, mate.
What I'm trying to say is it's within a commute.
Excellent. Okay, well, I want to just want to say thanks to all our listeners for tuning in. Thanks to Chris for talking about the Amstrad. And, keep tuned to the Retro Asylum, guys. You got anything to say before we sign off?
Go on, mate.
That'll be a no.
No, I have, but I'm going to let Dean go first, and I'll criticise him for going on too long.
Yeah.
Me, go on too long? Never. I'd just like to thank all our listeners. I'd like to thank Paul for being a top host. He's been very good the past few episodes, doing all these interviews. And, yeah, just keep on listening, and we'll see you soon.
Thanks for that, Dean. I've just hosted this show, and you just thank Paul for being a great host.
Well, previous shows.
Yeah. Steve, you've done a splendid job.
Thanks,
too.
Man. Just pull that knife on me back.
Yeah. I'd just like to thank the guy who bought the Retron 5 off Steve.
Yeah.
For allowing to fill that gap. But no, Chris, thanks for coming on. I've always liked listening to the stuff that you did. So back to the Super Happy Fun Time show and Sausage Factory. So yeah, guys, definitely give it a listen. It's funny you say it's not retro, but it does touch on. I think a lot of developers just in general have an appreciation of where games have come from. So it does, you know, the shows do tend to go into that direction to a certain extent.
Well, I can't help myself. Sometimes. I remember playing that back in 1983.
Yeah, you got to know where you came from. But outside of that, we are driven by the community. You know, we have plans for episodes and we talk about certain things, but the Amstrad was something where we were told by people in the community, you guys should do more stuff on Amstrad. So it's thanks to people actually saying, well, fill that gap, go and find someone. We had the NES episode recently where the Drisk went and spoke to the guys from Retro Game Squad, because an American podcast that talks about retro really does fill a gap on the NES. Yeah. And the same with, same with Chris. So, if there are any things out there that you want us to cover, things to jump on eBay. He's done the GX4000 for, he's made the ultimate commitment to the Retro Asylum. And so keep it coming. We're only as good as the feedback that we get from the community. So, Just keep it coming, guys. Yeah, we really like to hear what you liked and also what you didn't like as well. What you want more of and what you want less of. Pole position intro.
Awesome. Okay, well, yeah, thanks for listening anyway, guys. I'm going to sign out here. So, we'll see you next time.
See you soon.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.
Thank you.